we're going to hold until Mary gets here to vote on the minutes.
And we're going to next something around. We're going to move the pilgrim pipeline presentation up. So, come to the table. I have copies of this. I don't know if you all got it. If you want a hard copy, you can have one.
I'm good.
Light reading, third time reading. Okay. Thanks, first of all, for giving me the chance to speak with you all tonight. I just wanted to talk to you about what I know about this proposed pipeline project, how I came to be involved in it. As you may know, last month I introduced a resolution of opposition of the town of Rosendale Town Board, which was adopted unanimously. New Paltz, the town and village of New Paltz have adopted similar resolutions. The town of Rochester, this just last week, adopted a resolution. It's not actually in the path of the pipeline, but it's they adopted a resolution supporting us in our efforts, and Marbletown is about to as well. And in New Jersey, 17 cities and towns have passed resolutions of opposition to the pipeline. A bill was introduced into their state assembly opposing the pipeline. PSE&G, their major utility in New Jersey, recently rejected the request by the company to use its right of way. So I want to sort of talk about why, you know, why there is all this opposition to this, and also urge you to consider passing or introducing a resolution of opposition at the county level, because that carries particular weight with decision makers that will be involved in this decision at state and federal levels. I first became aware of this project in this summer, in July, because I was contacted by very upset residents in my community who had received a communication from this company, the Pilgrim Pipeline Company, to survey their property. And this information was presented in a way that really made them feel like they didn't have much of a choice in the matter. And so I said I would look into it. I actually brought a copy of the letter, if anyone wants to take a look at it. I said I would look into it for them. And I called the company and tried to get some answers about what they thought, you know, what they were telling landowners and what they thought their rights were. And they wouldn't be straight with me. So I finally, you know, took their letter to the Association of Towns and got some legal opinion of our town attorney. And it turned out that, you know, they didn't have any right to enter people's property, that they were presenting it as if they did have this right, and they followed up with property owners who refused to grant access. A couple of property owners came to our town board meeting saying that they got a visit from the company saying that they were going to be hearing from their town attorney. So they've been very bullying and misleading with property owners in Rosendale, and I've read reports of that in New Jersey and elsewhere. I can't speak for other communities, but that's definitely the case with Rosendale. So I started, so that was my introduction to this. And I started researching the project. There wasn't a whole lot written about it, but I can tell you that the company, Pilgrim Pipeline Company, was created for the purpose of constructing this pipeline. It has four principals. Two of them were our former executives, oil executives for Coke Industries. Two of them are real estate developers. the Coach Industries has a pipeline company, a crude oil pipeline company that has about 4,000 miles of crude oil pipelines in the country. They did receive the biggest civil fine ever imposed for violations having to do with pipeline spills. In 6 days, 300 pipeline spills, 2,000. So that company's record is not great. That doesn't necessarily reflect on this company, although the ties to it were a concern for me. The Silicon Pipeline Company is proposing to build a 178-mile, it's really a set of pipelines. They've been saying it's a pipeline, but it's actually two pipelines. One is going to carry Bakken crude oil from its Shipyard Rail from North Dakota to Albany, and then it would go by pipeline to Linden, New Jersey, where there's a Phillips 66 Bayway refinery, and the other pipeline will carry refined products made from just crude oil and gasoline and home heating oil and other products. The pipeline is proposed to run through in Ulster County through the towns of Asopus, Hurley, just a tiny corner of Hurley, Lloyd, New Paltz, Spotted Hill, Rosendale, Saugerties, and Ulster, and the city of Kingston. Other affected counties in the state include Albany, Green, Orange, and Rockland counties. The company is hoping to obtain permission to use the right-of-way of the New York State Thruway for as much as it, well, for most of the center line of the pipeline. It would hang a right and go down along 287 toward Linden. There are definitely portions of the pipeline along the way that veer off the thruway right-of-way. In Rosendale, it veers off pretty significantly. I'm supposing this has to do with constraints, topographical constraints along the thruway right-of-way. I don't know, but there are definitely large areas where it traverses private property. And these maps, personally, I don't have a hard copy of the maps, but they are available. I can send a link. I can send a link to you forward around. A little bit about Bakken Shale. Bakken crude oil is produced from the Bakken Shale region in North Dakota. It's unusual in that it's produced through hydraulic fracturing. That it was long known that there were oil deposits there, but it was never economical to exploit them until that technology was developed. So the Bakken Shale boom is a rather recent event. Again, it really took off in 2008. And just to give you a sense of the volume of crude oil that's being moved around, in 2008, there were 9,500 carloads of crude oil that were transported by rail. That number increased to 234,000 carloads in 2012, and then 434,000 carloads in 2013, which is the equivalent of 300 million barrels of oil. There are 42 gallons per barrel, so it's a lot of oil, and that number is increasing every year. Bakken crude oil is unusually volatile, and the reason for that has to do with the process by which it's extracted, as well as the nature of the geology. It traps more natural gas in the oil. So I'm sure you've all heard of some pretty frightening rail incidents. There was a rail derailment in Quebec, in a town in Quebec that was carrying Bakken crude, and 47 people died, and it leveled half the buildings in the commercial downtown. There have been a few other explosions, fireballs, fires, but no one was killed in those incidents. But it's pretty frightening, and it led the Federal Pipeline Safety and Hazardous Materials Administration, which regulates pipeline safety in the country, to issue a warning. about the particular volatility of Baffin crude to the public, to first responders, to people that work the rail line, etc. The company has made some claims about the pipeline, and I looked into these, and I just want to briefly review them. One claim is that the pipeline would be a safer mode of transporting crude oil than would rail and barge. And from what I found in my research, basically, it's a mixed bag. The reality is that they all modes of transport carry risk. Just based on the federal data collected by FENSA, the acronym for that agency I cited, pipelines spill more oil per time mile than do trains. But the incidence of injuries and fatalities has been less than trains. There is some, and it's my belief that the data may be skewed because the oil transported by pipeline, much of it is not Baffin crude oil, so you've got, a mixed sample in there, and the vast majority of crude oil transported by rail is Baffin crude oil, so unfortunately the agency doesn't disaggregate by, the location of where it's taken. You're not comparing apples to apples entirely, so it's not entirely clear. But another important point is that the company is suggesting that the pipeline will replace oil and barge transport, and it's not going to replace oil and barge transport. First of all, the pipeline will only carry 140 million. Gallons per year, and as I said, it was 400 million gallons per year on carried in 2015. The other issue is that we can't export crude oil in the U.S. right now, although the Obama administration is considering relaxing those export restrictions. But we do export and have a booming export business in refined products made from crude oil. And right now exports, they're really booming for gasoline, for heating oil. And so the market that we're serving here in New York, or serving as a transport for, are both foreign and domestic. And it's really about meeting there is domestic demand that will be met, but there's also a lot of foreign demand that will be met, and there's been a growing demand, so this is really about adding capacity and not replacing capacity. There's also a flexibility in moving oil by rail that you don't have in pipelines, so the industry is still also going to want to keep the rail option open. So basically, the bottom line from what I can see is this is really just adding capacity. And also, just on the safety question, it's important to keep in mind that it's not just transporting crude oil, it's also transporting gasoline and other flammable products. From an environmental perspective, as I mentioned, pipelines spill more oil per ton mile than do trains. Just to give you some statistics, pipeline operators reported 1,880 crude oil spill incidents, as I said, nationwide between 2003 and 2013, which averages to about one incident every other day. In that period, 44 million gallons of oil were spilled, gallons groundwater, so for waterways, farmlands, and woodlands, and resulting in over $2.5 billion in property damage. One of the main problems with pipelines is poor detection, leak detection. When a train derails, you know it pretty quickly, but it can be months sometimes before a pipeline leak is detected, and it's often detected by the public and by first responders, and only 5% of the incidents reported was a leak detection equipment that determined there was a problem. The third claim they make is that it will improve resilience by providing more secure supply of oil, it is, or of energy. It is true in terms of severe weather that a pipeline is going to be safe. You know, there's less danger, I suppose. We're going to live in an earthquake-prone zone. So, you know, major storms, there's definitely an advantage over rail and barge. But I would argue that there are far better ways to bolster our resilience than by building a pipeline. The company points to Hurricane Sandy and the fuel shortages during that time. In New York, they were caused by, actually by power outages at the gas stations and terminals. Governor Cuomo has initiated a plan to address these potential shortage issues during severe weather events, including strategic fuel reserves and a backup power supply. And to me, that's a much more sensible approach. And over the long term, over the longer term, we'll be more resilient if we reduce our dependence on fossil fuels than if we increase our dependence on fossil fuels. So I'm going to stop there and just see if you have any questions.
Anyone have any questions?
Was the company going to pay for easements on the property?
There's not been anything about that yet. It hasn't gotten to that stage. I think, I should actually talk about the regulatory, just mention a few words about the sort of the process, the regulatory process. So they're doing these preliminary surveys so they can get, the company can get ducks in a row and then start the formal process. They need essentially a change in policy and an exception from the New York State Thruway Authority, which hasn't granted this kind of right-of-way for this kind of purpose in the past. It is also inconsistent with the state DOT's accommodation plan, which doesn't allow for longitudinal uses of the right-of-way except for telecommunications. So, you know, this would be an exception, so there is a bigger hurdle. And they've had sort of conversations, informal conversations with these two, the authority and DRT, but have not started any processes. They indicated at a public meeting in New Jersey that they were going to start that process this month. So I haven't heard anything. But it's definitely the kind of thing that actually I think should be stopped because of, you know, because we don't, I mean, this is the first crude oil pipeline in New York State. You know, we don't have this. The PSC has regulatory authority over natural gas pipelines, but they don't have any authority over crude oil pipelines. And the FERC doesn't have any authority over the construction of crude oil pipelines. So it does. And it regulates, you know, the price that of the oil that flows through the pipelines, but not the construction. Our resolutions have been directed toward our original resolution was directed to the Thruway Authority chair, the State Department of Transportation chair. And as well as, you know, all the usual suspects for governor, federal and state representatives. So, but they haven't gotten as far as they still have to see if they can get their permission to even use the right of way. It would be very complicated. It would be much more complicated if they had to get all the easements.
But to Carl's question, if they did get the approval for the right-of-way, would they still need easements then for all the private property?
They would need easements. The question is whether they would be able to get... what they've been telling landowners, property owners, is that they're a transportation corporation, which would give them eminent domain. They have to be certified by some higher authority to be, you know, a public utility providing a public benefit in order to have
you can't
that.
Just claim,
you can't claim that you're a transportation corporation and take someone's money. So that has to happen first. And honestly, I don't know who would grant that in this case. I mean, you know, she's doing her style, and that was because it crossed borders, international borders. It was the State Department that made that, that makes that determination. And I don't know who would do it in this case.
Can we get a copy of the letter?
I'd like to see it, but I'm gonna have to.
Yeah, that'd be great. It's interesting to me that without private property owners calling you as their representative, that you might not have even heard about it yet.
Yeah, no, it was really, really surprising.
Yeah, there was a gentleman that spoke at the legislature that talked about how, you know, he wasn't intimidated, but
right.
Many people would have been with that same approach and information.
Well, there were. I spoke at an informational forum on this, and there were people from, someone from Newburgh, someone from Fogarty. People had come, and like, we had this letter because we thought we didn't really have a choice, you know, can we rescind it, and so they can rescind it. Definitely what the letter says is that they are being asked as a courtesy to sign over permission, to sign on the dotted line, but that they must do the survey. And that sounds great.
Wow. Does anyone else have any questions or comments?
I have just a process question, and that is, if we decided we wanted to move forward, how do we go about doing that?
Somebody would introduce for the January meeting.
Exactly. At our next meeting, we would have to take the template of the Rosendale's resolution and
talk to the attorney and...
Well, we could do that. Okay. Make it relevant to the county. There would be some changes that would need to happen in the document. And then, I mean, one or multiple legislators could bring it forward and come through this committee to the floor. Carl?
I was looking online, you know, at maps. Do you have maps of the proposed path?
Yeah. So
most of it looks like throughway, except where they can't go, and then it looks like private property owners.
Right. Are you looking at it right now?
Yeah. I mean, there's sections, so each town has a different section.
Yeah. Okay. That's how we have it. You have to look through all the maps.
So mostly the state would grant them right away to the throwaway.
Well, the DOT would have to allow that to happen.
This is probably the lion's share of the whole pipeline.
That's most of it.
You know, it's just every once in a while, one of these around something.
Mm-hmm.
Which just would be kind of hard to, you know, I mean,
there's a lot of other infrastructure involved that is not clearly indicated in the map that they provide. And pumping stations have their own issues.
They fall underground, right?
The pipelines are underground, the pumping stations are not. And you're right, they need to never set every...
And even underwater?
Yes, it's passing under... all of them. The Rondell, the Wallsville,
How wide is the swath? I mean, do we know how wide the swath is that they would have to cut to dig for the?
No. All I know is that they told property owners and they told me that they had to survey within. This is not going to be how much digging they do. This is what the area they have to look at for weather impacts and everything else within 500 feet of the center line.
And is it fully dug, or is it like the aqueduct? You know how the aqueduct is sort of a raised profile?
They say underground.
But the aqueduct is underground, right?
Right.
But it's
yeah.
like raised underground,
yeah.
like the ground.
In terms of depth, we have no idea. And also it crosses throughway it would be quite disruptive to construct. But it would go I'm imagining under the creek. I have to go under the river from the creek. So, it's a project.
An aside, but I think it's relevant, is that in response to the amount of exportation that has increased from the United States in the past few years, Saudi Arabia just decided to go for rock bottom prices and full out. They're not waiting. They're not trying to make their resources last anymore. And so that may have a negative impact on the investment in this, but I think our job is to be sure that the residents of the county are treated, residents and businesses and property owners are treated fairly, and that we look at the potential impacts. So, but I just thought that was interesting that, you know, when was the last time we saw $3 a gallon for the food? That's the reason it was. Saudi Arabia is bottoming out the price of oil, and they're going to push ahead in production. So that's going to also delay a lot of the incentives for the next few years for more exploration. And it may have a negative effect on Keystone and some of the other projects that are waiting for approval. But I think the big question is, with all this development, what's the effect on climate change? Is it going to exacerbate climate change? And I think it's pretty clear that it will. So I think there are a lot of reasons to start to put the brakes on.
Are there any other questions for Jim?
Thank you. 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 Thank
you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
It could be
cotton, I think.
Issues of a permit to be a transportation company, and then
page 4. I think at some point we should use
for additional other things.
One comment at the table, just so that it's clear.
They'd be setting up, I think, electrical charging stations.
Sure.
They are plug-in vehicles, but charging stations. Right. So that's the third paragraph down.
We're setting up electrical plug-in charging stations.
And then on page 5, instead of ethyl, I think I said ethanol.
Okay.
With an A, E-T-H-A in oil. And it was on page 10, it was marked Lowry instead of Dowry. And I don't know Dazzle's last name, but I'll get it to you.
Dizzle. No, that's his first name.
Dizzle Dazzle.
I have just two changes. One, looking out for John's intentions on page 3. Says Chairman Hardy noted the ceiling of how well flow control was thought out prior to implementation. You might want to clarify that was
not
captured.
Well,
yeah. So that if someone were reading it later, they wouldn't misread your intention of your comment.
Okay.
Fair? Page 7. The check reference. These dates went out irrelevant to the revenue. Any other comments on the minutes? Okay, so all in favor? Aye.
I'm saving because I was not here.
All right. And now on to
the Resource Recovery Agency. Thank you for being here. And you want to smile as well.
Okay.
Not a lot to report other than as the year comes to a close, the finances have been good. So right on target with what our projections were, so that's good news. And most of you know, I guess, we did tour the Dutchess Waste Energy Plant last week. I thought that went pretty well. Tracy was there, Matt and Joe, John Perry. Four out of those five board members were there. The one board member could not make it, Catherine. And it was myself and Melinda France from the agency. So I think that was well attended. Bill did a good job, Bill Caligero from the agency. Other than that, we really have a lot to report. It's been pretty quiet, which is good. You have questions for me?
This is something that, Tim, I apologize for not making a couple of the previous meetings. I had a lot going on at work, but one of the concerns that I heard from my town supervisor and the town board in the town of Shongum is, as you've been talking to the towns about the transfer stations and the options and everything, or the agency has as a whole, the board and yourself, that you had engaged a lot the Supervisors Association, which doesn't necessarily speak for all the supervisors. So moving forward, I know it's more difficult because there's a lot of them, but if you could reach out to the individual supervisors in addition to the Supervisors Association, because I know that I can tell you my supervisor doesn't go to the association meetings anymore. So,
What are they asking for? Do they hold a special meeting for them?
I mean,
I just don't have a lot of
okay. I mean, maybe to have a meeting at the RRA with all the supervisors instead of doing it at the association meetings. Just a thought. That's just something that was brought to me by the supervisors. So I'm going to just bring up at a meeting. Not that you're doing anything wrong. It's just he doesn't go to the supervisors. So that's where you'd normally go. But I think that there's been some... somewhat of a breakdown of the Supervisors Association into two separate groups, the ones who go and the ones who don't.
Oh, okay.
How well is the Supervisors Association?
I'm sorry. Not as well as they used to be.
My observation is that if there's regulars, there's some that float in and out, and then some that don't go at all.
Yes, you know, I think I can understand, not to ever put words in your mouth.
Please.
But sometimes... there's a little clique that speaks that others don't necessarily agree with, and you know, there's little personalities in politics.
Not unlike the legislation.
The legislation doesn't come over, I think, so don't do that.
But I understand. I mean, I personally haven't heard as many gripes about the way you folks proceeded with your budgets and the decisions you made. And the accommodations that you made, or maybe that's not the right word, accommodations that then was reported sometimes in the press. That's not the press's fault. That some
squeaky wheel gets the quote.
whatever you want to call that. And I said accommodations compromise. You know, I thought you guys did a good job over here before to try to move us through this period. And some of the folks that complained a lot didn't necessarily represent everybody.
I think that's exactly what, and thanks for putting it that way. No, really, thanks for putting it that way, John, because I think that one of the point wasn't necessarily against you guys at the RRA on his behalf, but I think saying that, you know, we're not, we don't all feel the way that they have been making it out to be, the negative thoughts and the negative feelings about some of the plans that you've come up with.
Additionally, I thought you sent letters to every one of the supervisors. It's not something that we...
No, it's not. Did you ever receive anything from John in response to anything that you sent to him that you're aware of?
Sorry.
That's fine.
But when I do send letters, just so you know, I don't only send it to the towns at transfer stations.
Oh, no.
I said that to everybody, including the town of Kingston, who doesn't have a transfer station. It goes to every chief elected official in the county because you know, there's some like Woodstock, Dresden, Sheriff, Sarbanes, transfer station, and things like that. I want everybody to be, well, the big transparency, I want everybody to be aware of what's going on. So I did send those items. And I will take that into consideration from that, if it's where it occurred in.
Yeah.
One other thing that what came out of this, is at least on the MSWC in the end, once these rates take effect, the towns are going to be totally self-supportive. So the other, and the city of Kingston.
Right.
And so the 85% of our users of the system can in no way, shape, or form complain about their rates when the contractor comes in, or roofing contractor, whoever it is, complain that they're supporting the town.
Right.
That's gone now. Mm-hmm. Towns are being self-sufficient now. So, the Public Benefit Corporation, we're here in public, the entire public, not just people who use town transfer stations, but the other people that maybe are a town resident come directly to us, they don't use the town transfer station, or the people that pay subscriptions and so forth. So that whole issue, now we're treating everybody the same. No one can complain to either end.
Well, that was a big concern of mine, was that the 85% of the users that use a hauler were subsidizing the towns, and the people who use town transfer stations were receiving a better rate, which is a concern, I think, for flow control as a whole in being, in getting sued by a hauler and having the validity of the law challenged. That was a concern of mine.
That's always been a concern.
Yeah.
And that goes away now.
Yeah.
That issue goes away totally. And I gave Matt a spreadsheet tonight. These were rates. This is something that we developed a while ago. And I just want to use the town of Albany example, because this is the transfer station that I use. But under the original proposal, and that's been watered down a little bit with the recycling, but under the original, if we had our original proposal, that's what those numbers reflect. The town of Albany would have went up approximately $20,000 a year. Now, they use punch cards. And on their punch cards, they sell punch cards that has 10 punches on it, so you get 10 bags. Each punch is represented as a bag. The way that works is that they sold 2,000 punch cards last year, I asked them. Now, there's 10 punches per card. That's 20,000 punches. And their rates would have gone up $20,000. So what does that mean? The bag rate goes up a dollar. So for me, in my family, I dispose of one bag every 2 weeks. I have a family of four. We recycle everything. I have a 7-year-old and 11-year-old. So my garbage rates now, transportation went up. Should have gone up $2 a month. And then that would have equaled. And all those numbers, we did a breakdown for every town.
Maybe we could get a
first case scenario.
Okay.
That's if we had the $85 a month for recycling. Those numbers are right.
And my sense was that the supervisors that do attend the association were comfortable with the compromise. It was a compromise. Because their concerns were raised, and not everybody agreed, and a compromise was achieved. So I think that bodes well moving forward, because we have some big decisions to make coming up.
I think it all worked out well. And like I said, I'm not sure. if everything goes well, too, I mean, the rate 2.5 weeks, by the way, just one thing I shouldn't have said is that for the second year in a row, we're not going to have to adjust the rates for 85% of our users. For that 15% we're talking about now, we not talking about by volume when I say 85%, but we're right on target for another $103 for next year, which is what we had this year. So so for 2 years in a row, we'll be on $103.
I just want to applaud you and the board for your patience and working with the towns and trying to come up with maybe an agreement that not everybody agrees with, but an amicable agreement that people can, everyone can walk away feeling like they got a little something out of it.
Thank you. Thanks. I appreciate that. And I want to give credit where credit's due. This idea of the compromise of the recycling, that really gave me thoughts you threw out there. We talked about it.
We're lucky to have them.
point some people say that.
I'm going to just pull it out of order since you're here so that you all can get the update on the climate, the Solid Waste Disposal Improvement Commission. Kristen, I put together some letters that I'm going to send out to all the haulers that are on the list, but I would like to talk with you, Sam, offline to just get some feedback on who you might recommend as some of the top ones that you can follow up, because we don't necessarily aren't going to expect responses immediately, as well as to the recycling community. I'll send you and your board a list of those in the recycle and reuse community that we're sending to, but that's not an exhaustive list. So any suggestions, any further suggestions for that community would be great as well. So far, Leon has graciously agreed to serve. The chairman has agreed to serve. I'll be serving. Manna will be serving. I'm waiting to hear from Trish Jardine, from Ways and Means, and then we'll start to get the additional members, the at-large members as well. So we'll need to do this fairly quickly. So I'll probably be reaching out to our committee via email for the suggestions, and then the same thing to your board and you via email for additional suggestions so we can get started. I know I had a brief but good conversation with Leon earlier, and I think everyone I've talked to so far is really excited to finally get this going. So it should be good to get out of the table and all bring our concerns and put our heads together. And obviously, within the constraints of open meetings, which I'll look into that, everyone's welcome to attend the meetings, also these public meetings.
Okay,
Sean.
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Even coming off of the tour and all the previous tours, there's a lot to think about, a lot to talk about. To really look toward a solution, which Rick shared with me a letter that he sent some time ago to the same end. So finally happening. Any other questions for Tim and for yes, Carl?
Madam Chair, did anybody take pictures of your recent tours?
Unfortunately, Carl, my cell phone is in my truck being charged right now. Other than able to show
it. Yeah, we'll definitely share. And Carl, also, we're going to look to do some of those we've been talking about over the last couple months, some of the tour that we did last cycle, the Oneida Herkimer, and even the Waste to Compost facility, potentially again for other members of the legislature. I think it would serve everyone's interest to see it. Yeah. Guys, one's an issue. But also, I think both of those are probably, I remember we needed to wait till a little spring.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions for Sam or the board members? Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Just for everybody's information, our meeting this month is at 3:00, not 5:00.
Okay.
So if anybody plans on coming, come at 3:00.
Okay.
But we're going to have some food and stuff for staff afterwards. So if they come to the meeting, you might get some
something. And I do want to say too, not just any breaking news, but 3 years ago we submitted our solid waste management plan for DEC review. Still working on it? Still haven't done it.
Oh, yeah, I thought the breaking news
was good. Well, by Memorial Day is coming on, but I still haven't seen it yet. And last I heard, they're still working with lots of. What they're doing is they're doing the solid waste, they work on one county at a time, and as they complete it, they're trying to move on to the next county. But they expect it to be done with Rockland much earlier, but that's still moving.
Are they going to Orange next after that?
I don't know how she'll do that for us. But who knows if this commission comes up with a report in a year, maybe we conclude that was always the management plan.
I just looked at it. I just saw it on my desk. I was going through papers and it said 2011, and I was like, oh, what is this? And I was like, oh my gosh, it is. That's the plan.
2011, And
4 years from now, we'll be talking about it again.
Yeah. It's a 10-year plan. We're getting 3 years into it.
All right. Well, thank you. Okay. We're going to move to American Alternative Fuels. I don't want to mispronounce your last name. Can you Gambatera. Very nice to meet you.
Thanks,
Mr. Gambatera, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I wanted to thank the members of the committee for allowing me to come in and speak on behalf of the pilot programs with Mobile and to answer some questions about potential environmental impacts and benefits that an alternative fuel program may offer on a pilot basis and then ultimately on a larger basis for the county. I sent some information in to Jay today, and I just told him to circulate to everybody.
We just got it now.
Yeah, and I tried to keep this, obviously the universe of information on what we're talking about is vast, so I tried to keep it brief and to the point on what you're concerned with, which is what are some of the environmental impacts of a program like this, and then also ultimately what are some of the environmental benefits of a program like this, and how would it work, and I apologize, I don't know a lot about what the board has discussed and considered before, so I can talk a little bit about what we discussed with the sheriff and what that program would look like, and then maybe answer some questions for this group as to how it would work and sort of how we can talk about some of the concerns you guys have.
Okay.
Does that work?
That sounds perfect.
Okay. So I had an opportunity to meet with the sheriff, I think maybe last year, and we looked at, we've actually done hundreds of programs around the country, but we've done a lot of them recently in the New York Hudson Valley area. We're working with the city of Yonkers right now. They did a 20-unit pilot program for their city. And we got to, as we started that program, we met with the sheriff for Ulster County to discuss the pilot program. What we discussed with him would be a 5-unit vehicle conversion. And what we do is we convert the sheriff's existing vehicles to operate on propane so that instead of just running on gasoline, those vehicles can now run on alternative fuel. We don't, from the sheriff's operational perspective, we don't change anything on the vehicle. So his deputies continue to run the vehicles normally. As the vehicle runs out of propane, if it were to run out of propane, it will convert over to gasoline and allow the deputy to continue running duty cycle. So from an operational and safety perspective, the sheriff was really satisfied with the way this program works for him. He's not changing anything about his vehicles except the fuel that they run on. One of the nice benefits for the sheriff is, he derives two great benefits. One is economic, and then the other is environmental. From an economic perspective, even with gasoline dropping down to $3 a gallon, propane right now is under $1.40 a gallon, and dropping precipitously. So as it sort of keeps pace with gasoline, as gasoline continues to drop, propane continues to drop. So it's somewhere right now, if the sheriff were involved in a program, his cost per gallon would probably be under $1.20 because he's got a different tax perspective than other users do. So he's got a really great economic incentive, but also as important is his environmental footprint. He has a real opportunity to reduce greenhouse gas emissions within his fleet, and he doesn't really have to do anything different to do that except switch to an alternative fuel. So the analysis I sent over to Jay today to present to this group was an analysis of a Ford E350 van, which is pretty standard for what he's using. He's considering using his prisoner transport vehicles for the pilot program because the miles that they do, the weight of the vehicle, the gas miles that they use, so they're less efficient than some of the patrol vehicles he uses. So it's a great test for him to see what are his fuel savings and how does the system work on a regular operational basis. If you look at a vehicle like that, he reduces his greenhouse gas emissions by 7,153 pounds per vehicle per year, which exceeds the weight of the vehicle. So, the gross vehicle weight on that is probably 5,900 pounds. Just by running his vehicle on propane for the year, he saves about 7,200 pounds of greenhouse gas emissions for the environment. So that's a little over a ton of emissions per vehicle. So just on a one-year program, every year he takes 35,000 pounds of CO2 out of the atmosphere. which is fantastic for him and for the county. So the county really has an opportunity to do something great from an environmental perspective without really forcing the sheriff to do much of anything in terms of the way he operates his vehicle fleet now. Our data, one of the things that we have to do to convert vehicles is we obtain certification from the EPA that the vehicle has converted one as clean or cleaner than it did on gasoline. So we do side-by-side testing on the vehicle first on gasoline, and then we run the same vehicle on propane. Our emission standards have to, in this case, exceed, either meet or exceed what Ford's emission standards were. So we exceed emission reductions on every attempt. So whether you're looking at NOx, whether you're looking at CO, whether you're looking at CO2, the emissions are lower across the board on vehicles. One of the other items I wanted to include for the group is looking at if you look at upstream emissions on I think it's it's right here. It's an analysis of the different fuels that you put down on. And it discusses everything from electric vehicles to natural gas vehicles. Auto gas is also propane, so I just want to clarify that. So if you look at it, propane is already cleaner than gasoline, and one of the things that people look at when they consider alternative fuel vehicles are electric vehicles. And, you know, there are substantial upstream emissions with electric vehicles that aren't considered. So a lot of times people will come in and talk about how electric vehicles are substantially cleaner, and they are, if you look at the electric vehicle in and of itself, but it still has to be charged and powered and everything else. So one of the environmental concerns there is what are we looking at upstream, and what are we dealing with? With propane, you don't have upstream emissions. You're dealing with whatever the emissions are from the fuel that's burned in that vehicle, and that's what you're looking at. And there are, you know, it is substantially cleaner. So,
can we sorry, do you want to go through your own thing?
No, not at all. I prefer to answer questions because
okay.
I know that.
Yeah, because I have questions about that.
Sure.
But you want to start
with? Yeah, you know, I learned a long time ago it's where you draw the box, and when you're looking at data like emissions, et cetera, and a little bit concerned that the what you're calling upstream emissions for the compressed natural gas may not include a lot of the data that is coming out about the amount of methane that leaks from fracked gas, et cetera. And then when you say, you know, this huge amount of upstream emissions for electricity, it depends on how it's generated. And so, you know, I'm assuming that this is sort of a national average, but for electricity, if it's generated by solar, by a solar farm, that would bring that way back down. So, you know, I have some concerns about the data and how it's represented.
And it could. That would be a fantastic alternative. You know, I'm a huge proponent of solar, so if we have, and it's interesting, I attend a lot of alternative fuel. No, I'm in the vehicle business, but there's a lot of overlap in what you'll see at alternative fuel shows. And one of the more interesting things I saw recently at a show I attended in Massachusetts was now incorporating solar power into vehicles. Not necessarily to power the whole vehicle because they're just not there yet, but now to power the auxiliary systems within the vehicles, and in particular they're looking at big diesel over the road trucks, reducing their idle time using solar power to really what generates a tremendous amount of emissions on diesel trucks. They're looking at ways to deal with that, and solar is starting to play a role in that, which I'm, you know, is a pleasant surprise for me, you know, to sort of see that develop.
Also the concept of using solar, because we've been talking about it even in this county, solar in its infancy, using solar to power charging stations for electric vehicles, because in that case,
again, as Min said, this, the upstream emissions would come nearly all the way down. If you had a fully solar-powered charging station that was powering your electric vehicle.
Right. If you can do that, it is a great concept and certainly worthy of exploration.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem that a lot of my users have, and I can't speak for the sheriff directly, is that there are limitations on what electric vehicles are available. You look at what I'm going to pick on the sheriff because that's who we're looking at in a pilot program. You look at what the sheriff's uses are versus what vehicles are available. And, unfortunately, electric vehicles are still at the stage where they're smaller and lighter versus some of the uses that the sheriff's going to have. So whatever it'll be, an E350 van is not going to run on battery power anytime soon. I think they'll start to come out with the next generation of vehicles. I'm looking at the new Ford Transit that's coming out, which is now, they've gone from an 8-cylinder engine down to a 6-cylinder engine, and they've made it a lot more efficient and still managed to keep the GVWR rating on those vehicles so that they're trying to address that particular issue and make them, heavier duty but lighter in what their footprint is and how they're powered and everything else. But I still think the problem will be, making an electric vehicle say you work for all uses. Just like a propane vehicle doesn't work for all uses either. It's just it works for certain things well, and for other vehicles, like smaller vehicles. I will tell you, in 8 years, we've never converted, say, a Honda Accord or a Honda Civic. We just don't, because they're so efficient now, it doesn't make sense to convert it over to gasoline. But that would probably be one of the best vehicles for the type of program you're looking at, which would be an electric-powered vehicle that you can charge through solar means, which would be fantastic.
Right. Can I ask for clarification? You talked about the Yonkers program.
Yeah.
What, I don't know if you said, what kind of vehicles did you do in Yonkers?
So we've done a variety down there. There are 20 in total. We did, I think, four of their large park and rec trucks. So they're like a GM 6-liter engine with a sort of a rack body on the back that they use for their parks and rec group. I think we did four of their transportation vans, like a 16-passenger van that they have within the fleet. We did five of their Impalas, and now we're doing, they expanded the program a little bit. They have 10 Patriots, so they're sort of a small GD platform. And they use those for supervisors and parking tickets, stuff like that. But they're high emissions vehicles. So they asked us to do 10 of those for them as part of their program. So they try to pick and choose a variety of vehicles within their fleet, and their fleet's large. It's like 750 different vehicles. So they sort of pick and chose amongst the different subgroups within their fleet, and then said, these are vehicles we'd like to try this out on and see how it works on different platforms. Because it's really everything from a 14,000-pound rack trucks right down to this little Jeep Patriot. I drove it back from Yonkers, the end of last week, and it's tiny. So it's an interesting program in terms of what they've chosen to do. And their idea is they put a fueling station in already, two of them in the city, and their idea is to run the pilot program for some period of time. They haven't defined what that period of time is going to be, with the idea of expanding into their total fleet if they can do it. That's the program that seems to work well for them.
Can I ask you? I don't know if anyone else. So on with the sheriff's department, are we doing? Is the proposal to do all his vans? And this may be a question for John, or just a portion of his vans? How many does he have?
Five.
And how many does he have?
Prison transport vans.
So that's all.
I believe he only has five.
And did you look at other vehicles for him, or did you go on his suggestion, or what was the thinking with the vans versus
can I just say how it started?
Yeah, definitely.
Was last March when I made my little speech. Mm-hmm. I included this in it, that I think it's time we move forward. But I'll say the only one in the county
who has any jurisdiction or authority came to me was Paul. Nobody else from the highway department, social services, health, anywhere came. Paul said, I think it's a great idea. I'd love to try to do that. It's the right thing to do for costs and environmentally, you know, all the things that you might not think Paul was concerned with. And we chatted, he thought it was, you know, I kept him abreast of it, and then you got to figure where to start, and Jay was very good, and somehow she called somebody who, maybe a union rep or somebody that she knew who knew somebody was doing a project, and with Mayor Spano,
right.
And I know him from over the years, and the next thing we got a hold of this gentleman, and they had their meetings, and then you came down with another chap, right? With you guys.
We did, so.
And I went to that meeting. It was the only one I'd been to. Listen, the sheriff had his staff there, and it sounded like it made sense.
I guess what I'm wondering, though, is, I mean, for me to understand fully how it makes sense, I'd want to know, you know, how many miles per gallon currently those vans are getting and how many miles they're running. But in the kind of program that you're talking about in Yonkers, like, I wonder why, if we were going to do a pilot program, why we wouldn't do it like that, where we look at several different kinds of vehicles instead of all of one class of vehicles.
Nobody else came to me and said,
but the sheriff has Impalas, and the sheriff has.
I don't know that there would be.
I don't know.
I don't know that the interceptors would be the place to run.
We can go around and we talked about that. I mean, I saw that, you know, these guys have done them in Georgia and all around the country, and one of the big things that cops ask is, well, when they shoot at us, will it explode? Well, it doesn't explode. You know, there's all those things. It has to start somewhere.
Right.
If I had said to Paul, okay, Paul, let's convert your, talk about converting the fleet, he would have chased me away.
I think when we sat down with the sheriff, it was twofold in terms of why we selected this group of vehicles to start with. One was the consistency of the mileage. So he knows from an operational perspective how many miles they're doing on a regular basis, and that they do the same routes over and over and over again. So from an apples-to-apples comparison, he's got a group of vehicles that the drivers are fairly consistent, the routes are fairly consistent, and then the annual usage is fairly consistent. So I think it gave him a good means of comparing what it was like on gasoline versus what it would be like to run it on propane. And I think the other one was, and this is we run into a lot, is the introducing a new idea to a police group, or any group for that matter, but let's say a police group in particular. Starting out with vans is the easiest way to do it, because they're not in the patrol car, and you're not making a change on the patrol car. You're doing it on an auxiliary vehicle within the police group, and it's an easier way to introduce change to the group. And you know, the sheriff did a great job in terms of doing it. We came down several times to meet with the sheriff's group, and on one occasion, the sheriff just introduced us to his more senior group and said, look, these are people that I would want to introduce us to, and also have them understand what the safety ideas are here and why this is a safer fuel than gasoline is. And, you know, so I think he's thought out why this would, you know, why this group of vehicles and how it would work. And it's not, you know, it's something that we've been through before, that auxiliary vehicles, generally speaking, is a great way to start a law enforcement program.
Do you know how many miles annually these vehicles get?
As I remember it, it was 30 or more, except for one. There's one van, I think, within the group that he may or may not do, that's local only, I thought.
I think they just go from over here.
Right.
To the courthouse.
Okay.
They bring them from the jail to the courthouse and back.
Right.
Yeah, not the Ellenville, not the Woolworth thing, not the... Well, yeah. No, he's saying that particular van, my commute from here to, you know, from the county building to my home is 60 miles round trip. So, and you live right there too.
So anytime they're coming to the Gardner Town Court or the Shangham Town Court in Worthing or Marlboro, they're right. going to do a round trip of 60 miles.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think those were the vehicles that they were doing between 30 and 35,000 miles a year regularly. So those were the ones he was interested in doing.
And, you know, it seemed to me that some of the data that one of the lieutenants, Mike's lieutenants, brought out was showed him. You know, a van like that, 10 miles to the gallon, 30,000 miles or 50,000 miles, whatever they came up with, sort of payback on their own data of less than 2 years.
I think it was longer than that. But it was
they
it was
showed
longer
other
than
vehicles.
Than
but
was,
anyway,
yeah,
we
but
could go
was,
out and round
with that. Yeah, it definitely was longer than, it was refuting what was proposed, but it still was... Sort of
do you remember, it was the bottom one, and
and how many miles per gallon, those vehicles, the ones we're proposing to do it to, how many miles per gallon do they get currently?
So they're going to currently get between 9 and 10.
Wow.
Yeah, E350s are terrible.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder why we have them.
Because they're the only way to transport.
Yeah. I think what they're economical only in the sense of what they do. So they're used for one or two things. Either they're transporting a lot of cargo in the utility sense, you know, so mm-hmm. lots of the services that you use them because they can load them up with a lot of weight in the back and still transport a lot of things economically, or for multiple person transportation. So, you know, in this instance, it's prisoner transportation, but most of my customers that do these style vans are in the you know, private transportation groups, and you know they're regularly putting 12 people on a van and running a long time. But from how many people are in the vehicle perspective, if you were to divide that out, I'm sure it makes a lot more sense.
If they're running full versus just one or two people,
right? That's their operation. They have to do what they got to do. Yeah, I mean, I suppose they might even take somebody to Dunmore once in a while. I don't know if they use that or the squad car. I just don't know. I mean, it's...
Yeah. Well, did I understand that there is no difference in miles per gallon in CO2 emissions that year?
So one of the benefits of it is all of the different measurable emissions, mm-hmm. whether it's NOx or CO or CO2, there's a between a NOx is smaller, it's like a 5% reduction on your NOx. On CO2, you're between 12 and 15% reduction on CO2 levels. Same on CO, you're between 12 and 18% reduction on CO levels. So from an emissions perspective, just changing the fuel on what we're looking at here, which is a highly, let's say it's not a very fuel efficient vehicle, does well for the environment. You know, propane is just, it's just the way that fuel is made up. It has less carbon atoms. It's just a cleaner fuel all around, so it does well. I mean, you know, going back to the original point about it's never going to be as clean as that type of fuel. I mean, that's why I think that will continue to develop and be the future. I mean, it would need to be. You know, I mean, one of the things, you know, that we talked about even in my own household is we have to do something about the climate now. You know what I mean? And one of the benefits of this is we don't make our customers change much. So we're not saying to them, to the sheriff in this instance, or to my other regular customers, you need to change the vehicle you're driving. Sometimes they can't. They can't make that kind of change on a dime, but they can implement a change like this and then make a substantial reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and actually do something beneficial for the environment without really feeling it substantially. So we're not making him, you know, like you're saying, when you look at this vehicle from that perspective, you say 10 miles per gallon is the best we're doing right now. And you know, the transit will do better. So as we advance into the next generation of vehicle on that E6 platform, it will be better. You know, it'll be 15 miles per gallon instead of 10, which is still much better than where you are now, but it's still not the answer, you know.
Right.
And even at a 15 mile per gallon vehicle, you're still deriving that level of emission reduction benefit, you know. We did a program for UPS where we did 750 trucks for them. Their greenhouse gas emission footprint reduction was tremendous, you know, because that vehicle is worse than what the sheriff's vehicle is running. And the emissions reductions that we generated on that big, it was like a big Chevy 6-liter engine. The emissions reductions on it were phenomenal. Even NOx reduction was 50% NOx reduction on that vehicle platform. So it was a substantial environmental win. UPS didn't do it for that reason. They did it because it was a cost saver for them. The Canadian government gave them a substantial tax credit to do the program. But from an environmental perspective, as a secondary benefit, to me, the primary benefit, you know, as when I take off my business hat and I'm a resident of New York, that to me is a tremendous benefit. The CO2 reductions on those vehicles were 11,000 pounds per year. So it's 5.5 tons of CO2 out of the atmosphere for every UPS truck that they run, and they did 750 of them, and you know they run 300 miles a day. It's a ridiculous, you know, a ridiculous amount of pollution. You know, and again, they've tried everything. They implement electric vehicles when they can do it. They implement natural gas vehicles when they can do it. And then they implemented propane vehicles where they can do it. Because I think they have to weigh out, just like you guys are doing, if you can make a solar charging station work for electric vehicles, that's a fantastic win. You know what I mean, in terms of a green footprint.
And is your firm then, I know at some point the chairman was talking about the fueling station being supplied by the vendor. Is that you? So you would supply the fueling station, and how would that work? Is it a locked-in rate, or?
Yeah, so the propane company, who was Perico, and they came in and met with the sheriff as well, mm-hmm. They provide the fueling station, and they can do one of two things. There's a lot of flexibility on there in terms of fuel costs. They can lock in for them for the year. They can lock in for... or they can lock in at a certain adder to the cost of propane. So, you know, for a lot of people, this year have locked in at a set rate. So propane has gone down, but they may be locked in at $1.40 a gallon instead of $1.20 a gallon. They'll lock in for the year. So it really is up to the sheriff as to, they'll give him a couple of different options.
But do you then lease the equipment, or do you purchase the equipment?
I would say it would be leased. It's not really, there's no lease cost to it, but you don't own the equipment when it is not.
You mean the filling?
Right.
And one of the things that the chat talked about that day was that if they were transporting in a different area, this company, if that was the one, has other stations in other counties.
That's right.
So they could just pull into Greene County or mm-hmm. wherever they were.
And why, John, no disrespect to the center, but why propane rather than compressed natural gas? And that's a nice question.
You know
question.
What? I came into
I
this thing.
I don't know.
On compressed natural gas. That's what I came into. Because we have two filling stations in Ulster County.
Right.
But then I found out that you need a bigger tank. So you can't put a bigger tank, if I remember correctly, in the back of these vehicles. You could put a bigger tank in the folks that go around, let's say, to inspect the restaurants. They don't need three people.
Right.
But nobody from the health department came and spoke to me. Nobody from anybody else came and spoke to me. So we talked to the sheriff. And Jay and young Don were telling me all the time, LT, you got to go LT. That's the only way. I don't buy it. I don't understand. Until we had a couple of meetings and I did my reading, that made this practical for this. I mean, there is a fill-up station at the quarry and one in New Falls. So the big drawback was $1 million for a fill-up station and a compressed natural gas. We got them, but it's.
The conversion was more difficult,
the conversion is in the vehicle. I mean, right. I think you can embellish it because
I'm naive to it.
So we do both. We do natural gas conversions and we do propane conversions. It really depends on what the vehicle platform is. So for the sheriff's van, he has got some limitations. One is what's available to him in terms of space on the vehicle. So I can put propane tanks underneath the rear of the vehicle where their spare tire is, and that'll work for him. I really can't put a propane tank inside the vehicle. You can, but from his operational perspective, we can't have that. So he's limited in terms of where I can put tanks. And just to give the group an idea of what we're talking about in terms of capacity and cost, natural gas and propane will both operate that vehicle. So it would run basically the same whether I converted it to natural gas or propane. It's what kind of storage capacity I would need to get enough gallons for the sheriff to run it and have it make sense. So if a typical vehicle, let's say a 16 by 34 tank, so it's like a 16-inch diameter and 34 inches in length, will give you maybe 22 usable gallons of propane. That same size tank for natural gas will give you 5 gallons of natural gas. So it requires a lot more space to compress the gas down and give you what they call gas gallon equivalent. So if you use a 4-to-1 ratio, that's about the space I'm going to need to give the sheriff the same capacity on natural gas as I could on propane.
The chart you have talks about natural gas, and if I understand it correctly, natural gas is obtained by drilling or by fracking, which is a form of drilling. But propane generally comes from the cracking of petroleum. Am I correct about that?
It's a byproduct of refining of petroleum. Yeah.
Okay. And that doesn't show up on here, per se, on this chart, the total emissions. Because you have compressed natural gas and ethanol. Auto gas?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see propane.
The auto gas. Propane.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
So then, you know, the same question I had about compressed natural gas and whether or not they looked at in upstream emissions, whether or not they looked at the whole sort of life cycle, because there have been papers published by Cornell and others saying that for natural gas, that it approaches coal if you do a full life cycle analysis and you look at the methane leaks at the source. And so I don't know enough about propane to know if that's also an issue, but I'd like to look into that.
The issues that natural gas face, and I'm not an expert on natural gas, but I'm aware of what you're talking about, that you know, that there are methane leaks in the way they handle it. That is a much more, just the same issues that I run into in converting a vehicle, they run into in, let's say, storing and transmitting natural gas, which are, it's a gas, so it means it doesn't transport as well as liquids do. They have met, you know, some of the issues they face, like the methane leaks. Propane transports, you think of it as a vapor because you run your grill on it. Propane is actually a liquid and transports as a liquid. So it does do better in terms of transportation than natural gas does. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but it probably would.
The petroleum distillation process that I need to understand, you know, what the emissions there are, because that's what gets overlooked in calculating emissions. But I think that's probably easy enough to find out.
That's, you're talking about in terms of how they derive fuel, right?
Yeah, and what greenhouse gases and other emissions are, you know, fugitive emissions are, you know, not part of what gets captured and used, but what escapes and is released.
Just touch on the rest of what I was going to answer before in terms of cost. Propane conversion or usually costs about half of the cost of natural gas. So I think we talked to the sheriff, I think we talked about $5,000 conversion cost per vehicle. If I were to do the same vehicle on natural gas, the cost would be $10,000. the claim, the installation and the front-end components, basically the technology necessary to run that vehicle on alternative fuel, are cost the same, relatively speaking. The tanks are really what cost me. The compression cylinders that I need for the gas are really what drives the price up between a propane conversion and a natural gas conversion.
And I don't know if you mentioned it or not, but sure, one of these vehicles had a severe flat tire. You could just move this to a different vehicle, the conversion unit.
That's right.
It's not destroyed like the vehicle is.
Right. So it's a universal system. It's designed to move from vehicle to vehicle and then also from manufacturer to manufacturer. So if the sheriff decided down the road that he was going to go from a Ford product to a Chevy product, we can take the system off the Ford product and move it over to the Chevy product for him. And the cost of moving the system from one vehicle to another is about $2,000, so it's less than half of the original cost to move it.
What's the lifespan of the unit?
So we have customers that are on four life cycles, which means it started out on one vehicle and it's
right.
Worth fourth vehicle. So the ultimate life on that, you know, we have the customers with 1,000,000 miles on the equipment, but you need to maintain the vehicle. There are maintenance items, but overall, the equipment that will transfer from vehicle to vehicle are the computer, the fuel tank, the fuel lines, and the injectors are designed to go from vehicle to vehicle, and we do that regularly.
Would this tank be, is it specific to the E350, or would it go on to other types of vehicles?
It goes on to other types of vehicles.
Only vans, or I mean, like life-size vehicles, or how?
Yeah, typically. So what we do for our customers is most customers stay within the same vehicle size, you know, for lack of a better word. So used equipment will transfer easily from the first generation of vehicle to the next generation of vehicle, and that works well for them. Other times we have customers that are making wholesale changes. So they've gone from, you know, we had customers that went from the Lincoln Town Car, you know, in the transportation industry, and that car phased out. There were no more. So they then moved over to some sort of SUV or an alternative vehicle. The tanks we used originally for them were made to be installed in the trunk of the vehicle on the package shelf. So they were designed for that one spot and would never move over to another spot. So what we did for those customers is those tanks are good forever. We took the tanks out. We did put different style tanks together on the new generation of vehicle at no cost to them, and then we took the old one back and then refurbished it and then used it for something different. So that's what we typically do for our customers if we need to.
How long have you been in business?
8 years.
I guess one other question, just sort of for the group is, if this is something we decide to go forward with, and I appreciate your being here, would we have to go out to bid for this project?
I think so.
So it would be to any company
that
has propane or that offers
services. We talked about that. Even with the sheriff, I do not know.
There's
probably not too many people
going above a certain dollar amount. It's not a special service.
Yeah.
It's gotta be
there are a couple of people.
Although the executive's office has been playing fast and loose with professional services.
But we don't.
I agree.
We don't have to go forward.
There's only a couple people doing it. I don't remember where. Not necessarily right around Ulster County.
No. So we just have to be located in New York. There are probably four companies around the country that do what we do. There's one in California, one in Michigan, one in Texas, and we're in New York. So, you know, there are other...
These five vehicles at $5,000 would be about $25,000.
That's right.
And there's no expected cost for the fueling station?
No, except we talked to the sheriff. The sheriff would be responsible for running power out to the pump and dispenser. So, and potentially pouring a concrete pad if he needed to support the tank. But I think we looked at the facilities, and I think the facilities would support the tank, but you would have to run power out to them.
We've got to have an electrician at buildings and grounds.
Hey, well, we got to, if it went that way, we just got to do it. That's all.
I mean, this would be above ground dispenser?
It is above ground. Above ground tank. It's one skid unit, so it's a tank, a pump, and a dispenser is one unit. And the dispenser looks just like a gasoline dispenser. So from a usage perspective, there's very little change in terms of the way they've been spent. On a positive note, though, in terms of product go spill or product whatever. First of all, propane has no environmental impact. So from an EPA perspective and DEC perspective, it's not the same as your like if you have gasoline within the county, you have your bulk storage requirements. The DEC doesn't monitor that because there are no impacts from that. Also, unlike gasoline, where you could have a let's call it an accidental spill on propane, if there is a it's a connector, so you have to. It's a locking connector mechanism. It will not dispense. You can take the nozzle off of the dispenser and pull the nozzle. It will not dispense product. It must be connected to the fill port on the vehicle to dispense product. If it's not connected, it will not dispense. So from an environmental and safety perspective, it's a lot safer. Yeah.
I just thought of one more question. The dispenser would be compatible with the county's gas boiler systems that we've already gotten?
It is.
Okay.
Completely. It could be completely integrated into that. So for your monitoring and reporting, it fits right in with what the county is doing now.
And you mentioned the company that would provide the station, but again, I question if you'd have to go out for bid for that if more than one provides the station. But once they provide the station, you're locked in to getting the propane from them because technically the leasing station can't go out to
with the lease. The lease agreement and the purchasing of the fuel would, I imagine, be in the same RFP.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They're put together and choosing for a period. I think for Yonkers it was a 2-year period of time renewable after that. But for the first 2 years it was. They locked in a certain rate and had Perico had to supply them with fuel at a certain cost. And then
is there a minimum amount you have to use?
I don't know what they worked out in that. That depends on, I think that really affects cost versus whether it'll do it. I think that they'll look at 5 vehicles and say, we'll put it out there. And I think if the usage is what we discussed with the sheriff, I think the cost would be in line with what Yonkers is doing right now.
Do we know what year those 5 vehicles are? I mean, that's stuff that's like now getting hyper-specific about this, like that's something I'd want to know, like what...
The sheriff has detailed
records about that. Because if we were to consider making an investment in a transition to a vehicle as a pilot, like I would want to know...
I would assume he would know even if he was going to get a new one.
Right, but that's, I mean, I'd want to know that, and I'd also, I mean, I'd actually also like to talk to the sheriff about, again, I appreciate that he's thought it through, but he has more vehicles in his fleet than simply the patrol vehicles or the vans, and as a pilot, it would be ideal if we were going to pursue this. It would be ideal to see this over different types of vehicles.
We could do it on the dive van. We could do it on.
Or if there were, I mean, they have vehicles. I know they have vehicles that are not patrol vehicles, that are not marked vehicles, that they use as.
The urgent vehicles.
An urgent vehicle or something else. You know what I mean? It would make more sense to see it across a group of different types of vehicles than just one. Whole set of vehicles, because that's
the problem with the
vehicles
is they're leased, I think. They lease them.
Some we do. But beyond that, I'm just saying.
Listen, we got to get that far first.
Yeah.
You got to say yes, no, maybe, right. And then, I mean.
I guess in my mind,
if he's got a command post, he probably only puts 3 miles a week on it or something, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to know more about the vehicles that we're talking. It's been very helpful for me to have you here and hear this in this kind of detail.
I'm glad. And, you know, just I want to thank you for coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. And before you leave, I want to introduce you to Leon Smith over there, because he's running the RRA, and they have another interesting vehicle. Just for your own edification, and nothing more. I'm not a stockholder in the company, but since you're here and you had a chance to listen, okay? I'm sorry about that. Madam Chairman.
Oh, no.
If you want to, I brought some cards.
That would be great.
If I can ask Matt, and this way, if you have questions, I have no problem with any kind of follow-up question, and if I don't know, I can certainly point you in the right direction to find out. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be things I know well. You know, obviously, converting vehicles, I know well. When I start getting to some of the areas you're touching on, I don't know it as well, but I'm sure there are people that do know it extremely well that we can reach out to.
And the last time we were together, we were talking about some police department in Georgia. Was that you or was that
that was
you guys.
Yeah.
That was a bigger job.
Yeah, they've probably been running 120 patrol cars now for over 6 years.
So they're one of the
first meetings. And those are patrol cars. They are. Yep. We do a lot of patrol cars, but it was just that I think from a introductory standpoint, it made a lot of sense. I don't think, I will tell you, I can't speak for Sheriff, I don't think that they were opposed to doing any patrol cars. I think he thought it would be easier to implement by doing it in advance.
Right. They were very mileage specific.
Yeah.
They went from here to here and back.
So, yeah.
And it wasn't like they were, you know, they were easily
comparable.
And comparable.
Well, then you're not varying the speeds greatly, so you can...
Well, just said the same driver.
Yeah.
Train, doing, and that's why...
But on the flip side, I mean, if you're really doing something as a pilot program, or you're really considering something as a pilot program to test how it works, from my perspective, it absolutely makes more sense to test across a series of types of vehicles versus take one whole class and just use that class.
So,
especially when that one class, we're using a kind of vehicle that's so abysmally inefficient that I think someone might even argue that, I mean, to really, from my perspective, to really look at that, John earlier you said that's operations, and I'm not getting into the details of the sheriff's operations per se, but I would be interested, I mean, if he, when you said earlier, I don't know if he's taking one or three people, it's like, if he is taking one in a giant van, that does not make environment.
Well, I can't answer that. I do know. I'm like thinking about buying a truck myself, a new truck, just for taking my trash to the transfer station. And the damn thing still only get 20 miles to the gallon, for God's sake, 22 miles to the gallon. And that's just a little nothing.
Right.
So, you know, when you talk about having to be able to take 1, 5, 8, I don't know how many people it takes. Those vehicles,
But that's the point.
We also might have been thinking that the pilot was showing, you know what I mean, showing that information and how it's saving, and not specifically like across the board.
Right.
We may have been looking at it in what information we're looking for in a pilot program.
Right.
Versus, you know, a vast
information. And I have to say, in some respects, I can't argue with his logic in terms of those vehicles, because he will generate the best both return on investment and environmental impact by doing the worst vehicles within his fleet. I mean, they are.
His vehicles are not very good. I mean, the patrol vehicles do not get very... I mean, I have a list of the mileage. I don't have them with me, but his vehicles do not do very well on pretty much across the board. Plus, he also has some vehicles that are decidedly unenvironmental, like the equivalent of a Suburban or, you know, like the gigantic... We have
the Hummer?
Like a Hummer as well. So it's like... There's a whole
Can we up to the Hummer?
Pretty bad.
We have certification on that platform. That's what we should do it. But
it's better to get rid of
it's not like an H3, though. It's a military Hummer.
Oh. So it's probably a diesel then, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we wouldn't do it.
Oh.
would you be asking basically? So, but like Sheriff Apple in Albany County did van and patrol car. So because you wanted to test them on both.
Yes. I'm just saying logically that makes sense to me. Even on the flip side, when we heard from the executive's office, the type of pilots they were talking with, an electric or hybrid, it was across multiple use platforms for that reason, so that you could really see and gauge. And I think, I still have the concerns that Nana's raised, but I'd like to just do my research on the LPG, sort of the environmental impact on both the front end, even if I were to just take at the letter the back end, like the front end of the LPG impact. The idea of a pilot for me becomes more exciting when it includes something like a patrol car, because then, I mean, there's, I don't know how many, but 35 patrol cars. There's a lot of patrol cars in the fleet.
Well, we're not going to, if I understand this correctly, the potential benefit is reduction of emissions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not miles per gallon.
Right.
And it is some cost savings.
Right.
So, the cost is important, and you have to amortize that. But in terms of the environmental benefit, we're not going to be measuring that from the vehicles. We're going to be trusting the data that the industry is giving us, and then we're going to also look for other independent data.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's miles per gallon, you're measuring it. If it's emissions, you're taking existing data and saying, we're doing better by 7,000, whatever the units was per year, 7,000.
Right, you're not actually measuring tailpipe emissions, you're going on.
No, we are, just so you know. This is empirical data from, I have to test tailpipe emissions for what I put out on the road. So, for example, on that E350 van, I have to run the van through a EPA lab. I have to provide my results to the EPA, and they don't even accept what I run through the computer. I have to actually bag the results and send them out to the third lab who weighs the results and then gives them to EPA and says, here are the bagged results. So they're actually measuring the parts per million that I'm generating on each of the four
conversions. And on each conversion? So on
each class of conversion. So
it's already done. That you wouldn't do it on our vehicle. It's already,
I've already done it on a van. It's probably
an E350.
An E350 van with probably more miles than the sheriff's got on it now. You know, so we pick whatever we use as a voluntary vehicle. But what they'll do is so we test all of our vehicles out of the lab in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The results go from there. They get submitted to, we do two things. One is the emissions testing. So we don't, I can't just use general data. I have to actually provide specific data on each vehicle class that we do. Then on top of that, I have to demonstrate that the check engine light in the vehicle comes on when it should within tolerance. So the second part of what I have to demonstrate to the EPA is, and this is the potentially more environmentally damaging part, is not when the vehicle's running right and propane's running through it,
mm-hmm.
it runs at this level of cleanliness. If the vehicle onboard diagnostic system is non-functioning, meaning it doesn't register the way it did before, so when you drive your car now, if you're running rich or lean, like there's something wrong with your engine, your check engine light comes on at a certain point that the environment, that the EPA decides is what they're going to tolerate. So let's say it's 1.5% of wherever it needs to be, right, 1.5 times. That's where the light needs to come on for your vehicle, and that tells you that you've got a problem with your engine is not working right. That's where when that check engine light comes on, that's when your emissions really start to go out of whack. You need to do that. What I have to demonstrate to EPA is not just that I'm cleaner, but also that the check engine light comes on when it's supposed to. So we have to demonstrate that if we're running rich on a vehicle, meaning too much fuel going through at any one time, when I'm running too much fuel through, I generate all kinds of CO2 and CO emissions into the environment. I have to demonstrate that the check engine light comes on and alerts the driver that we've got a problem at the right level. Same on lean. I have to demonstrate that where I'd be generating NOx. If I don't have enough fuel and I have too much air, I generate all kinds of NOx, which is also terrible for the environment. check engine light needs to come on at a certain point. I have to demonstrate all those tolerances to the EPA for every vehicle class that I put out there.
And how many classes have you put out?
Over 350.
And you obviously have all that data.
We do. We have the data and the backup and, more importantly, the certification. So the EPA then gives us the certification to be able to convert the vehicle. And then also one of the first things, when we started 8 years ago, one of the first people we had to deal with was DEC in terms of demonstrating to their own group that what we were doing met their standards. So they at the time, really was new. So they needed to understand that the standards that they propagated and the testing that we did met their standards, and that the vehicles we put on the road were compliant, you know, to DEC standards as well. So, you know, they don't really regulate what I do now, but at the time when we put our first vehicles out, they definitely came in and looked at all of our data and went and talked to our test lab, talked to the EPA, talked about what we were doing to make sure that it was compliant with what they require.
Any more questions?
Thank you. I'll leave a card for everybody.
That would be great. Thank you.
And then, you know, if there are questions, please feel free to get us. There are some things Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate the time. I know I probably took more time than you anticipated.
It's important stuff.
Yeah, you don't know this to me enough.
Butterfly ring.
Yeah, there is. I'm not.
I wasn't here for the butterfly ring.
No, I wasn't.
I was.
I was here for a meeting when Carl was running the committee, and I was here for an hour, left to go to another meeting, came back again, and unraveled while I was gone. That was my favorite meeting ever.
Bye now. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Resolution. Well, the first resolution before us is resolution number 314, setting a policy. Move it for discussion.
Second. Well, I'll move it for discussion.
Discussion.
I think that was a great presentation. I think it's something we should start to move on. I mean, the RFP rules and everything like that would be handled with purchasing. I mean, at this point, we're setting the policy, and then the executive would be the one to implement it in the proper way. And if the sheriff's on board, it looks like this is going to be good for the environment, good for the taxpayers, and I think it's something that we should start. You know, we are behind the eight ball. I mean, you know, Westchester County utilizes Priuses for almost all of their on the road vehicles.
I had Krista again copy, even though everyone had in the packet too, of the green vehicle policies that I thought were most relevant, which are less about a pilot than more about a full green policy, which I think we ought to consider. And I know the executive, I'm going to come back to this, I know the executive put forward a policy which had it had some great ideas in it, but what I felt like was lacking, which this resolution has, is a goal. If you recall, the executive's response to this was a letter and then about a three-page policy, and if people don't have it, we can recirculate it, not this minute, and it talked about it talked about downsizing, right?
I was just saying, one idea was no good and the other one is much better.
And that's where that's my point.
And I'm choosing my words carefully.
I know you are. And that's where I think the green fleet policies, both of Ann Arbor, because I did read them all, and I don't expect that everybody read, so many of them, but that Ann Arbor and Dobbs Ferry, which was kind of a smart community, and actually the policy that circulated isn't
per se a policy, but the suggestion of the Climate Smart community, through the funding of Climate Smart Community, it's suggesting how they go about with the policy, which includes goals, and the rationale for why it includes some and others. I mean, you talk about creation. So to be perfectly honest, I felt that the chairman's resolution, just again now talking from my perspective and come back around, was for me an amazing incentive finally on paper to move forward with a more thorough policy, not just a pilot. And I had some concerns, and still do, but about LPG and the connection to fracking, as you talked about CNG and LPG. But I have to say that the presentation today for me was very helpful, and it raised specific questions that I feel like I may have been ready to be in opposition to a pilot program on LPG, and I'm no longer in that position. At the moment, I feel like I need to get some answers based on the presentation we saw, and then depending on those answers, I mean, coming off of some of Mana's questions, just some of the environmental questions on the front end, and then some specific questions for the sheriff in terms of his fleet and his openness to do a more diverse pilot, which if we were going to do, if we come around to doing a pilot, I think a diverse pilot would be a better one to really let us know how savings would go across the board. And I also wonder, I know that you chose the sheriff because the sheriff chose you, because the sheriff is the only one who came to you and was open to the concept.
Nobody else is interested.
Exactly. But I do wonder, in terms of, and this is almost a rhetorical question, but not really, what the legislature's authority is for setting, even if we don't call it a policy, if we call it a pilot for a second, because this really, right in front of us right now, that's what we're talking about, is a pilot. So what is the legislature's authority to put forward a pilot in the form of a policy and say which vehicles are going to go? And I realize we have the sheriff's consent, but I'm asking, could we say to Buildings and Grounds, we want it on this vehicle. We want, you know, these are the five vehicles we want it on. And I'm not trying to stir the pot. I'm trying to see what is the most, if we were to do this, what's the most effective way to do it, and what are we going to get the most information?
You know, Building and Grounds, I don't think so.
I just threw in the department out.
The district attorney, if he liked it, he could do it, if he had the money. The sheriff can do it. But the money was taken out, and nobody complained about the money being taken out. He had $20,000 or $25,000 in his budget. If he could find $25,000 now, he could do it. It's nice to have a statement that says, this is really a good idea, and you don't have the money, find it, or we'll transfer it out if you really feel that this program is something that's needed before we can make future decisions. And he said, but I don't have the $25,000. Well, then the legislature would have to transfer it from contingency.
Yep.
I mean, it's not like it has to happen tomorrow, necessarily, but we have to start somewhere. But, you know, the DA, he has a car. The sheriff has vehicles. I don't think the county clerk has any vehicles. I don't know for sure.
But I guess it begs the same question. I mean, and again, I'm talking, I was just using an example of Buildings and Grounds, but when, and we'll look at them only briefly tonight, but I think it is something we should bring forward as well from this committee, a green fleet policy. When we look at these policies, see, I did the research looking back, because incentivized by your resolution, John, and going back to when I was here and we had the Charlie Busick policy, which I was take-home vehicle policy, which Charlie and I worked on very closely, and that was superseded by an SOP by the executive when we took a charter form of government. So I wonder about the authorities. We are to issue a vehicle policy, a green fleet policy that's inclusive of everything. Are we going to get pushback that's out of your purview? If that's the SOP.
From what the reason I even put this in, it was, is our purview to say, we want to move forward with a green policy. We put the level there at 50% to say something.
Well, it said 75.
Well, 50 to 2020, 75 by 2025.
You know, this I mean, it's entirely possible. That's a goal. It's entirely possible if somebody did a pilot that they find out it's not necessarily sustainable. You know, and then it wouldn't happen in the same regard. If it's a constitutional question, I suppose the lawyers would have to figure
that
out.
Yeah, we'll look into it. I mean, I think that when you look at the more inclusive the policies that get at the nitty-gritty of how you reach that goal, which for me what's important is, one, that there's a goal, whatever the number is that makes sense, and two, how do we achieve it? I mean, the one commonality I saw across most of these policies is beginning with an inventory, which the executive's office talked about, but then, you know, downsizing, right-sizing. Most things talk about anti-idling policies being put in place and adopted by the legislature or the legislative body, which, to my knowledge, we don't have any anti-idling policy for county vehicles. You know, all these little things that add up to a lot, you know, carpooling, the take-home. The reason I keep harping on the take-home vehicles, the take-home vehicle policy, you know, between, you know, we have the issue of the sheriff, which
he's exempt from the charter vehicle policy.
Taking the position, but he's also taking the position that he's exempt from all county policy regarding vehicles. I mean, that's in his response to the comptroller. But I do think it's worth, when you talk about greening a fleet, you have to think about all those things.
Well, everything is cumulative, but you have to start somewhere.
You do. You're right. Nana and then Nana.
I would feel more comfortable with this being considered a pilot. I like the fact that it has goals, but I think the way to do a fleet policy is to meet with Amanda and whoever else worked on this and bring other examples, and that's going to be a little bit of work. I think it's worth doing. We might get some help from the Climate Park committee. My one question would be, I'd like to get some independent information on the two main reasons, as I said before, are cost and emissions, and I just want to check the emissions. I don't doubt that the cost is, that there's going to be a cost savings, and that's important, and I'm not minimizing that. But I would have time to try and get sort of a second opinion on the production emissions. So, you know, those are my thoughts on it. But I do think we need a policy. I really appreciate the fact that you put pen to paper and are asking that we take action. I completely support that, but this feels more like a pilot than a policy, and I think we should work together to develop a policy that everybody agrees. And just looking at the information we already have, I know how much work that's going to be.
And I think one of the areas in the county that uses a lot of mileage is DSS, like the foster care program. And the parent is like in Buffalo. There's required times for visitation.
That's going to be.
Whether they drive them all the way up there and never see the parent or not, there's still. So I think that's probably a lot of. I mean, you could be taking one kid up to Buffalo.
The DSS would be. The DSS is going to be trickier because the state reimburses those cars. State pays for those cars. Yeah. So I don't know if we can alter them without the state's permission. Because the way the DSS cars work is that they reimburse us for the cost of them, and then we buy them for a dollar from the state after 2 years or 3 years.
But on DSS, they have older vehicles. I think we determined that when we had some conversation about that. They have very high usage countywide, and if we do a comprehensive policy, maybe that's a very good place to start phasing in plug-ins that are solar powered or something. That's why I want to do a full...
Well, I'll tell you, I believe that we should make a policy and let them, and drag them along. They haven't done it. We don't have to work with Amanda, who made the statement that we haven't bought many cars when we bought 150 of them over a few years. If we make a policy, we're going to do a pilot, if that's what they want, but the money was taken away. But have a policy, and then say, now, you get your DSS people in line, you get your social service, you get your health department people in line, you get your highway department people in line. We've made a policy. We don't have to get their permission. Let them decide. Let them tell us what the emissions will be and justify it like this dude did, if he did it. That's where I'm coming from. They didn't do it. Let's make a policy. To me, you don't have to do a pilot if you don't want to. It makes sense to do a pilot. You can wipe that out, and then there's no pilot. Just make a policy, and let's see where they go.
Yeah. Ken.
Thanks. I just, you know, we've had discussions about, you know, doing a pilot, you know, doing a policy before doing a pilot or doing a policy while we do a pilot. I think you did a pilot before you make the policy. I think that that's the first step in the direction of a comprehensive policy. I don't think that you can do a comprehensive policy based only on the SRAC. You know, I think that you'd have to see a real-life example of something before we would do a comprehensive countywide policy.
I think that's a good point, although I think several things. I think that I agree with Nana in terms of I would like a little time to verify the data on the upstream or the beginning, the upstream environmental impact of LPG specifically, and I also would like the time to talk to Paul further about the rationale with the specific five vehicles, but also the possibility of potentially diversifying within his department. And I also would like to think through the policy, the potential, if we're happy with the answers, and granted we're just talking about this committee right now and the broader group gets it, but if we're happy with the answers from the upstream impact issue, then the potential of diversifying the program across potentially other departments with or without consent. I don't know how that works, but I'm sure I would like to know, though. Because
policy.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. This, and I also agree with Nana that this, as written right now, reads more like the pilot. The whereas there's talk about the policy, but I think we need to immediately get to work when you look at actual policy and the comprehensive policies. It's not done in the abstract. They have, you know, matrices for how you decide, make decisions on vehicles. They have all kinds of considerations.
My point about in the abstract isn't, you know, I'm not saying you do it in the vacuum without looking at data, but you're still relying on data from someplace that wasn't here.
Right.
On vehicles that aren't ours.
Absolutely.
With drivers that aren't ours.
Absolutely.
And so that's
but then you leave the policy, I think where that is, we need to figure out what the goal is, and then we need to allow how you reach the goal to be a little bit flexible in terms of that.
I can tell you when I co-signed the letter with John to Mike, you know, the biggest part of it for me was that before we would make a statement about at least 50% of the fleet shall use alternative fuel sources by 2020 and 75, it's upon successful completion of at least one pilot. And that to me is one of the most important things. And that to me is where it goes from just pilot, just creating a pilot program to a policy, is that in the resolves we have two specific policies.
Right, but to me, I personally, after seeing all these other policies and examples across the country, I would like to see a more comprehensive policy than a policy that is simply just the goal. That's what I'm saying. The other policies talk about everything from downsizing, right-sizing, idling. I mean, we can circulate them again, because those, I think, are the most relevant. And can I just see Doug Curry for a second? And also, I want to say, you can have it online, I want to say that the 50%, while I love it, and probably Man and I would jump for joy over the 50% more than, maybe more than anyone in the county,
probably.
50% is so gigantically aggressive, it blows away like San Francisco.
When somebody can't meet that goal, they write a letter to you. They write a letter to the legislature and say, here's the problem we're having meeting this goal. It happens in Congress all the time. It happens in the state. You have to, you want to make it 22%, 32%? All that's somewhat irrelevant in a way. It's let's get going. That's what
right.
It's about.
No, and
the original thing was do a pilot to see if it's even worth it. Then the budget was taken out of the budget. Right? We were told that it was no good. Okay, and nobody complained about it. So then you say, well, you don't want to do a pilot? Let's have a policy. Well, we don't know if we want a policy. 50% is too high. What is the data? I mean, other places are doing it. Yonkers, New York, Albany, New York, UPS or whatever, whoever he was talking about, they're all doing it. Let's run a little bit of a pilot and find out. I don't really care whether it was 2 350s and two high-speed sedans, but at least if you get a good inkling with the worst vehicle. But whatever, one way or another, either we do something and move forward, or we don't.
Yeah. My only other concern about this particular pilot is you're not comparing the various alternative vehicle fuels and vehicles. You're only looking at how much are you going to save? Because you already know what your emissions are, and you're not going to be measuring it from these 5 years.
I think that's not exactly correct. We're also seeing do they work. Maybe
yeah.
Some things don't work when they get 20 below.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, that's the other part of the pilot.
That's
right, when the guys say, hey, it broke down in 209 three times a month, then it's no good. We don't like them.
Yeah.
So that's part of a pilot, too.
Yes. Yeah. I agree. Where do we go from here?
I think
I do
this
care.
Is not earth-shattering.
It isn't earth-shattering, but...
Let's move forward. You know what? I'd like the committee to pass it. And then have another discussion. You can have a discussion on ways and means, or laws and rules, or... Let the executive come in and tell us it's no good or it's a bad idea. We don't have the money for it. There's all sorts of things can happen. If not, we just put it off a little further and then there'll be another dude come in and talk to us about...
Well, they're usually here to say it's a bad idea, so they're not...
I would like the opportunity now to get the upstream impacts verified.
Well, that still can be done, Tracy.
But I don't want to say yes to an LP. This to me, I totally want to see a policy and a policy.
But what if it came back in the next month?
Yeah.
This doesn't have to go into the legislature tomorrow.
No, that's what I'd like to do. I'd like 1 month to get that question answered and to talk to Paul. Just those two things. And then in that same month, what I would like to do is...
But it's still nothing positive then.
Hmm?
There's still nothing positive.
What do you mean?
I mean, if we said we want to move forward and some data comes in and says it just doesn't work, that's the end of it. You table it or you vote no.
Yeah, but I don't feel ready to say yes to an LPG pilot until I just have the most important thing right now for me is having the upstream impacts verified. And the two things really now are just that and talking to Paul about the possibility for other vehicles, really, and understanding the full rationale, looking at his full vehicle list, which I don't have in front of me, but I did have, I suppose, go with paper, looking at his full vehicle list and talking through, is there anywhere we could diversify if we decide to do this? And then also thinking through, would it make sense for any other department? I mean, probation maybe is driving in and out of there. I don't know who else is driving out of where that would be convenient, that fueling station.
I think the fueling station would probably be right in the back of the law enforcement center.
Right, but is there any other department that would be going over there? No. Anyone across the street? Yes, ma'am.
Right, I would like to make a recommendation as we move forward, and I think another month is going to be more than enough time to get questions answered about this pilot. I think it's going to take several months to actually develop a policy, and so I'm going to make a suggestion that we set a policy for creating, we do something to create a green fleet policy, and I'll have to figure out what that was, for county-owned vehicles to utilize alternative fuel sources and establish a pilot program. If we can modify that so it's clear that that's what we're doing, then I'll be able to support it in good conscience.
I'm confused. Can you repeat? Are you talking about changing the title?
Yeah.
But you're talking about setting a policy separately but changing this title as well?
I don't know what the word, because I don't want to say policy twice, but I'm just going to say it twice until we can figure out the other word. Setting a policy for creating a green fleet policy for county-owned vehicles to utilize alternative fuel sources and establishing...
Basically, you're saying setting a plan to create a policy.
Yeah.
And establishing a pilot.
Yeah.
That's not what this does, though. This doesn't create a plan to create a policy, so...
Not at the moment, not in the results, no.
But I will feel a lot more comfortable in helping the sheriff to find $25,000 to do this pilot to ultimately save money and reduce emissions if I know we are also committed to developing a multi-source, which makes the most sense for which vehicle, and a phase out of the vehicles that are not energy efficient and low emission, and a phase in. And that has to be defined somehow, and I don't think this does that.
Has everyone read the packet of the example policies? And I'm not going to be insulted if you haven't. I realize that it's a holiday.
No, I haven't.
Okay. So, because I'm gonna then, for homework, just since there were so many different policies on Dobbs Ferry, which was Climate Smart Communities, Mid-Hudson Region funded project, and City of Ann Arbor, which seemed to have a relevant policy. For Dobbs Ferry, it includes a template for creating a green fleet policy, because this is not actually their policy. It's the recommendation from Climate Smart Communities for creating a policy. So it might be relevant to us, and it includes definitions and the basis for the ordinance, the policy itself, strategies for, and it doesn't tell what the percentage goal, but it suggests a percentage goal. It talks also about vehicle acquisition requests and fleet inventory, all these things, which I do think, I did meet with Kim Million, the fleet manager, in the interim between the two meetings, and it was very helpful, and she had a tremendous amount of information, which I need to follow up with her in terms of, and she definitely has a tremendous grasp of the fleet. I mean, she was here at the meeting, but in further discussion, just understanding the details. But I would like to see a thorough policy, but I'm closer to, as Mara says, supporting the concept of a pilot, and by saying supporting the concept of a pilot, meaning finding the money.
That makes sense, though. I mean, just saying, we're going down the road to create something, work with a pilot. However she articulated it a minute ago,
mm-hmm.
said we're moving forward rather than just being limbo yes, we are moving forward with something very, very specific. All the rest of the things you talked about can be incorporated in something within a month or so.
We don't need any more time. Either. Yeah, I don't think
and we're never going to be able to hold our finger up and catch every flake of the mercury or coal that comes out of the sky.
It's setting.
So I thought, you know, it was a pretty good compromise to say, you know, let everybody know we're on notice of moving forward then. Oftentimes at different levels you pass one thing and then later on you pass something predicated on the results of what you're looking to accomplish. So I thought that was...
Well, then are you prepared to move forward on that tonight or do you need that other information first?
Well, given that it's going to get... I have to go through a lot of other committees anyway, as John pointed out. If we can send it to the other committees by just changing the title.
Well, it's not just the title. I think what would need to change as well is the resolve, because I think the resolve now would have to be, I'm going to paraphrase, one is we're resolved to creating something to talk about in the whereas, the development of a sustainable green fleet policy, and two, that we're resolved to support establishing a pilot program for LBD.
So can we do that by email?
We can do it right now.
Get it done.
Okay, so let's go through this really quickly. So I feel like all the whereases all the whereas up to the last whereas, would the last whereas you delete has, and it would just be inclusive, chapter one, green enforcement, investing in cost savings, and requested funding, check has, news has included, and requested funding for a pilot program.
I'm fine with that.
Okay, that just to put in second, and then resolved, we'll deal with the title in a minute. The energy, should we do it in our committee, the Energy and Environment Committee? Because what else will we, we're not going to resolve that the legislature is going to do a plan, a policy.
I would say that the assistance and the Climate Smart Committee, because this is a climate smart issue.
Can you just say that you will ensure it happens?
The Energy and Environmental Committee intends to craft a comprehensive policy.
We'll craft.
Okay. We might have to put it in here, but I would...
Comprehensive alternative fuel source.
A sustainable green fleet policy. Yeah. Just keep it simple. Yeah. A sustainable... Mm-hmm. Green fleet policy.
Vehicle policy. Oh, fleet is a vehicle.
Right. So, and resolve, and further resolve. That a pilot program is hereby established. To
for 5 vehicles in the Sheriff's Department to utilize LT.
I don't think I want to be specific with the Sheriff's Department yet.
I think that
we should
force ahead, I think we have to be specific, but especially for the funding.
Okay.
If it turns out that's something the attorney said, we don't have to be specific, we can always change it.
Can we just say the pilot program is hereby established to convert 5 vehicles to LPG.
You can end it there.
Period.
Yeah.
Anyone have any other thoughts on that?
and moves for its adoption.
Does we need to send it to the sheriff's office or no? I don't think we need to.
Tracy, I don't think wants to.
We just have to convert five vehicles. We're going to...
If it turns out we have to say Sheriff's Department, we can add that in laws and rules and ways and means.
I feel like the money would have to get moved from
contingency
to, you know, to whatever, however that works, but that's where it's going to that's where it's going to happen. I don't think it's going
to. I would like to make a friendly amendment to the part about the policy, because I really like the idea of setting goals, and I don't know that the 50 and the
75%.
25
and 50.
Well, we're not going to set the goals.
Oh. But including specific goals.
Oh, yeah. I think that's great. Yeah. I think that's great and important, actually. Where did you put? Right after the
energy and attainable goals or something like that.
A sustainable green fleet policy. Which includes
specific and attainable.
Which includes specific goals.
Okay.
All right. Because attainable becomes a matter of interpretation.
We actually have to hold on the handy board at this time because you've lost your court.
Yeah, okay. But we also have to do financial impact. Financial impact.
You don't affect the quorum, though. You're part of the vote.
He does affect the quorum.
Is that it?
Yeah, he does affect the quorum. So we
need to check it, but I think for now we say 25.
Financial impact, yeah. I mean, yeah, I would say 25,000. I wouldn't.
But there is none yet.
But there will be.
No.
If we're establishing the program, we're saying we're going to spend the money on the conversion. Ultimately, there's going to be where you expect savings, but right now we're saying.
Transferring the money.
Yeah.
Which would clarify that. You're just doing it, moving forward, and then if it reaches a satisfactory
conclusion, we have another resolution moving the money if we have a 25,000 in here. I guess we do have
that. There's different ways you can do it. You know, I mean, theoretically, if you transfer the money, if and when the time came to the sheriff's department, you could transfer it to the legislature to run the pilot under their jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Or still
in your program, and I mean, I'm not saying that's a good idea, but I'm just saying that it may be a possibility. Victoria probably would know that better than anybody. It is one way to establish a policy.
You're saying 25,000. That's based on all five vehicles being the van. If in your discussions with the sheriff. You propose
a
lot of
that might not be
25,000. But this is just as an explanation. It's really
estimated.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, your last two resolves are now deleted, right?
Mm-hmm.
Deleted the last two. Yeah.
I think I agree with Mama, and I agree with you, John. That I think can everyone please read the Ann Arbor and the Dobbs Ferry? Can we try to do this next month? I mean, I'll meet with Amanda, I'll meet with Tim, whoever we need to meet with as well, but I think we need to just get this through. I don't think it's wrong. There's so many examples out there. Feel free to read the whole giant packet if you want, but...
I brought my packet, and I cannot find Ann Arbor or Dobbs Ferry. I have lots and lots and lots.
Of course, when we turn out our pages,
great.
No, there's no reason.
From the mayor, too. Yeah.
Some
in Denver. Yeah, I sent Denver,
too.
So,
let's look at these two.
And if I would like to, if I can, with Amanda when you do, I want to really understand so that I can transfer that to the climate smart committee.
Okay, so a motion on the amendment.
Moved.
Second?
Second.
And what are we changing the title to before we start?
I think we had that.
Yeah, whatever manner of...
Establishing a pilot program, maybe? No.
I think it was on the other side. Hold on.
Establishing a plan?
A plan to create a... I had said green fleet, you had said sustainable...
I just sustainable green policy and to establish a...
Establishing a framework for a comprehensive policy. And creating a pilot.
And creating a pilot project.
What was it? What's the title?
What do you have? So far
what I have is setting a plan to create a green fleet policy for county-owned vehicles to utilize alternative fuel sources and creating a green fleet pilot.
Just for the alternative fuel sources, and the rest of it was right.
Establishing
the framework for a comprehensive green fleet policy and...
Or establishing a pilot program for alternative fuel.
Yes. There you go.
And committing to a green fleet policy.
Excellent.
Or committing to...
Don't need to go further. It's perfect.
To developing or creating.
Committing to creating a green fleet policy.
Perfect.
Okay.
Establishing a pilot program for alternative fuel and committing to creating a green fleet policy. My English is really knocked out here. Okay, so on those amendments.
All right.
Where's my
I'll move it.
Okay. Okay, all in favor? On the resolution as amended, which includes a financial impact.
Starting to move in second.
Okay. All in favor? All right. All right, and so for the next, we are going to have a January meeting. I don't know if our alternates have anything on you. Technically,
there is no committee until after the reorganization.
Okay, so that's the 6th. Right after the 6th, assuming we still stand as formed, then I would like to... I would like to schedule on the 6th. Assuming everything stands as is, on the 6th, we're going to schedule a meeting for this committee. So I'll come up with a tentative date circulated, because I'd like to get this done on... in January. There's no reason not to be moving forward. I realize moving forward. Okay. So, wow.
46.
No, we're going to local law request.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that's what you were talking about. Go on.
Okay. So, local law request, commissary home. So, I've spoken to Mary and worked with Mary, and what we'd like to do, we could look at proposed local law number 12. I was talking through some amendments on it, and we would like to move forward with setting a public hearing. In our conversation, we really feel like we would benefit from hearing from the public on this, and while we're not going to rush it through, it may require a second public hearing or even a third. It might not. I have no idea what we're gonna hear, what feedback we're gonna get. But I think kind of like John was just saying, like, let's put it out there, let's hear from the public, and then we'll move on from there. Local law number 12. We'll look at first. Everyone, I think, knows it's been a while, but there's two competing resolutions. Mary and I, local law number 12 was crafted. Mary and I have been talking about this for a long time, and Legislator Provenzano brought forward local law number 13 to my attention. But what we had been talking about was something more inclusive. Rather than Albany's law, which is just applied to chain food restaurants. And I think just to backtrack, because I talked about that committee before, I did call every chain food restaurant, not every single branch of McDonald's and branch of Burger King, et cetera, but for approximately 20 different chain food outlets in the county. A lot of them, by their own will, had already phased out polystyrene foam or were in the process of phasing out through corporate. And Mary and I just were have all long been of the opinion that if you, we believe that, there are alternatives that are costs, and I'll be able to bring that to the committee as we talk about it after the public hearing, but and I've given cost comparisons to the committee as well before, that there are alternatives that are cost within fractions of pennies or pennies, sometimes actually alternatives that are less when you're not talking about specifically biodegradable or compostable product. Biodegradable or compostable product totally changes the price structure. And the Albany law, which Legislator Provenzano's law is modeled after, requires that they be compostable or biodegradable. Mary and I chose to take that requirement out because we knew that would be a burden, especially to the so-called mom and pop shops, which John is one, and my family's been one in the past as well, so, and actually is currently, again, but in Orange County. So there are a couple changes that we want to make in 12 because we use 13 as the starting point of the model. So if I can talk you through it. So if you look at, okay, so intent and finding definitions, page 2. We want to delete biodegradable, the whole definition, because again, that was a holdover. It was also brought to our attention by Amanda that if we were going to require that they be biodegradable, a flaw she saw in 13 in Albany's law is that there are no standards. It just says biodegradable, but there exist standards. So if we were to use the definition, we would want to take that in. Compostable, delete definition entirely. County customer, everything stays the same. Food service establishment. Now we may be going back to change one of the same, but Mary and I would like to put some committee. So the prohibition, section 4, prohibition on the use of a disposable polystyrene foam food service ware. We, obviously the dates need to change, but we chose, as a compromise, and we both felt that it was a positive change to do a rollout in terms of time to begin with chain food establishments and then move to the other food establishments. We're open to the idea of doing it all at once, but we want to see your feedback from the committee whether or not the rollout was something that everyone thought was worthwhile.
I'm not quite there yet.
Okay.
I like the idea. I'm against it in principle, but I like the idea better of having a rollout where the mom and pop stores are going to be on a slightly different timetable to give themselves more of a chance to more time. A chain store can ship it to another chain store out of our sphere of nanny.
So there are two ways to do that. It's difficult to pick a date, which is what we did. We just initially put an arbitrary date in here. I think that if you look at Global Law Number 13, it takes what they do because it doesn't have a rollout. The law takes effect 6 months after adoption. So what would be ideal would be to have it take effect 6 months after adoption for chain food service establishments and then say 9 months or a year, whatever the number, unflexible after adoption for, the food service establishments. The county would affect the county. Just, Mary and I felt really strongly about this. I don't want to keep speaking for you. Mary and I felt very strongly, and this was another sticking point when we met with Jeanette, that and you'll see and see that the county ought to lead by example. So we just, other than food service establishments, the only other place that we affected was the county, but we didn't feel like the county should be passing a law to affect food service establishments and then using styrofoam cups in, you know, county purchase, you know.
Where are these styrofoam cups in the county?
Well, right there in our room or whatever. Right.
So, that's number C anyway. So you're going to put that date as the same 6 months after the plastic cup.
6 months.
Yeah.
They're
recyclable.
They're recyclable.
We don't recycle them.
What's interesting about that is we at our facility do not, but the 85% that use private haulers, they're accepted. Those plastic cups are accepted.
But how many of them end up as waste after because of, you know, because of the soiling of...
Well, cases are rinsed. And you haven't been to those facilities. It's pretty... They're not really picking out for dirt, per se. Like, when I heard somewhere...
Well, those get washed.
Yeah.
It gets fucking washed.
Yeah. So, okay, just staying on point. So, yes, that would be 6 months. So,
and what would be...
B, Mary, you want to do 9 months or a year?
And you're going to say a year.
Anyone else have it? Okay. So,
so that would be, so I was going to say December, but we don't know when this is going to get passed.
Right. So we could either,
yeah.
If you look at the model of 13, it says, it gets into effective date and applicability.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have to be specific in that section. We might have to be specific in both sections. It would just say, would end on fall, no dates on the section for prohibition, and then in the effective date, it would say the 6 months and a year. You know, the...
And for example, like Cornell Cooperative already doesn't use styrofoam. Except for an emergency situation. That's their policy.
Every once in a while, somebody sneaks some styrofoam into clear water.
Okay, so we'll get to the effective date in a second. Section 6, enforcement and notice of violation. Section 6A, delete the word primary. Commissioner of Health or designee shall have responsibility.
So what are you deleting?
Primary.
Okay, so really the only thing we need to figure out is how to do the effective date. And my guess is it should just be...
6 months after filing with the Secretary of State?
Yeah.
But then, because this section, it would say...
It's 1 year and 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I think it should be specific that it's about the, 6 months after filing a local law with the Secretary of State.
And then everything else before...
And then everything a year after filing with the Secretary of State.
Okay, so...
So A is 6 months,
so
B is 1 year, and C is 6 months again.
Okay, and maybe we can just vote on that and have legal figure out how to word it tomorrow for section 9. We're all clear, we only need 6 months, a year, 6 months.
How will people be notified of this?
Sorry.
You mean of a violation or
I think it should that we've given that responsibility to the Department of Health, who's going to balk.
We should make that a part of the policy to say, hey, every food service establishment or whatever you call them somehow.
All the food service establishments in the county have to be permitted by the health department.
Yeah, they
we've got all of their information. I would imagine that we'd be able to send them a letter.
Maybe before this is...
Well, even without sending them a letter, as long as their permit's come, they can be notified. It's not like you get permitted one time and that's it.
Well, no, you get permitted every year, and there is once a year inspection.
Mm-hmm. So it's part of that.
Under enforcement and notification of violation,
can we just say the Commissioner of Health or designee shall have responsibility for notification and enforcement of this local law? And that way they have to send out. It really should be with Department of Health.
If you're just inspected and then you can
First you send out a letter to the establishment, and then when you go to inspect, you make sure they got the letter.
But I'm saying without the letter, potentially you could find out at the end of when the year is already over.
Yeah.
They're very close. You know what I mean? Very close. So with a letter, you're covering it.
And the permits don't all the permits don't all come back at the same time. And they do.
Oh. And there's going to be, there's going to be address, I would assume. It's going to be on the website.
March 1st.
So we could go out with the permits, yeah. Okay, so I think that's good. Responsibility for notification and enforcement of this local law. You fine with that, Mary?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Motion to accept the amendment. There's one other thing we need to do, which is to set the date, obviously.
No, you don't have the date.
Oh, okay. So what we're asking Laws and Rules to do is to set it for the 6th, the organizational meeting.
Oh, God, no. No, that's a horrible idea.
If not, I talked to Vicki about it.
I do not support that, but I'm on Laws and Rules, so I'll air my grievances then. We have a lot going on that night. We try and pack way too much stuff into these meetings. That's going to be a long public hearing, and we're going to have, what?
What's the long public hearing going to be on?
This one.
Oh, this one. There's an already.
Well, maybe after that, if he shows up.
This is going to be a long public hearing, and then after this long public hearing, we're going to have possibly reorganizing. We're going to have to do a committee as a whole because we're doing a lot of resolutions at that meeting, and it's, none of the resolutions have gone through committee, and because of our rules, they all have to go through committee. So we're going to do another public hearing, then this public hearing, then committee as a whole, then elect the chairman for the next year, then do all the resolutions. I just think that's getting out, that kind of outrageous.
We would really like to see it on the 6th, but I guess we'll make our case there.
I'm just one vote. It's okay.
So we had a motion to accept the amendment. So we need another one to approve it and move it forward.
We do. Definitely. Okay. So all in favor of moving this forward as a whole, as amended, for setting a public hearing. the last guest for me,
No. I'm going to have to advance it to the floor and motion rule.
Okay.
You got one more time.
Okay. And then we have proposed local law number 13, which our rules aren't really specific about having to. I
don't
know if we can sit on it forever.
Yeah, we can.
What do we do?
I think we postpone it. I'd make a motion we postpone it indefinitely when local law number 12 passes, which I'm certain it will. Then at that point, and then it vaporizes.
Okay.
Second
on the motion to postpone.
All in favor? I
support that. Moving on. Resolution number 415.
Other than that, postponed, is that correct?
Yes.
Correct. Postponed, okay. So there's no
action on that.
And there's no
9G.
Oh, 9G or anything else.
I'm going to amend it to say it's been postponed indefinitely and you can sign off.
No, but I mean, there's no...
we don't have to. That's just the motion. That
I there's not any signatures to bring it to the floor.
No.
Okay.
If we defeated it, there'd be...
Correct.
Okay. Okay, so this is confirming reappointment of member to the Ulster County Resource Recovery Agency. Entertain a motion for discussion.
Moved and seconded.
Okay, so open the floor. Is there discussion on this?
I just want to, on behalf of my caucus, thank the chairman. You know, he gave us his word when the last appointment was I believe, unjustly not given to the minority as it had been over the years. And he gave me his word then that, you know, the next appointment that came up would come to the minority. Catherine Nielsen's been doing a good job for us there. I know Leon works very well with her as the chair of the IRA board, and just please, you know, I knew the chairman would keep his word, but I'm just pleased he kept his word, and we're very pleased to bring this forward.
Any other comments? Yeah, I'll go. We've had such a cooperative day that I don't want to end it on a show, but I want to begin by saying that my comments have nothing to do with Catherine Nielsen, because I also have worked with her. In fact, she may have even once been a Democratic appointment at some point.
We wouldn't want to call them parties, majority-minority.
But that's where it gets confusing. And so, and Ken and I have spoken about this, and we just respectfully disagree. So being consistent with my take, and it's still my belief, the last time I believe the last two appointments were correctly majority appointments. I believe that currently there are three members on the board that were appointed by the sitting or recommended by the sitting minority. That said, I recognize when I'm not going to win an argument, and ultimately it's the chair's appointment to be confirmed by the legislature, and I know the Republican caucus is behind this appointment with the chair, that the numbers work against me and my opinion and my argument. So again, it's not specific to Kathy Nielsen, but being consistent to my belief in terms of the appointment and my concern for the way that this, you know, you Ken said to me jokingly earlier about the next appointment being, you know, depending on the way that, but still, it's like that's my concern. You know, we're always chasing that. So I would, two things. I would like to reach some kind of understanding. I don't know, maybe we will never agree, but I also would like to reach a way, I think, in an ideal, because I regret the way that it went down last time, too, which I have said both publicly and privately, and in the future, I would hope that something that we can get through committee. These are really, really important appointments, and I don't know if there were any other candidates specific to Kathy Nielsen. I just don't know if there were any other candidates, because I didn't even know about this appointment until I saw it written down. So I'm gonna have to vote no,
That's all there is. I don't want to argue about it because I have no chance of winning the argument from my perspective. I place the responsibility for this ongoing dilemma with how poorly the law was crafted. And the law is of central interpretation, and it just keeps coming up. I think that, you know, I observe the RRA pretty closely, and I think Catherine is, you know, makes a valuable contribution. But I will also be voting no. I mean, I say also, I assume that you are voting no, Tracy. But I don't know what to do. We don't have five people. So
I don't know how that's going to work.
It's not going to pass right now.
Oh, it needs a majority to pass.
It needs a majority to pass, okay. And we don't, there won't be a quorum. I mean, you need four votes. Which one?
No.
Yes, you do.
No, I substitute for Richie.
You cannot substitute for Richie.
Yes,
you change the quorum.
If he was here, he only changes the quorum. He only changes the quorum if the entire committee is present.
That's correct. That's correct.
I don't know if that's true. Show me that in the rules.
Right now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It could be.
What, is he checking? Is he reading the charter?
The rules.
The rules. Okay.
Or the charter. I don't even know where it says it. I thought they changed the quorum by his residence.
I think it's about 10. We've played this game before.
I can't work. You don't know them inside out, so I can come with this in a while.
Rule 10.
The chairperson shall be
Can I keep my report while you're looking?
Yes, go ahead. Okay.
Yeah. And that way, I think what I'd really like to do with the Climate Smart committee report is we have a very good report. I'm gonna do a little editing, send it to Krista, and then when you send it around, could you go and send it to me?
I'm going to send something, the report to this
committee, to both committees. Most of what we did there, this committee is aware of. The previous month we had met with Amanda, this month we met with a representative from the Mid-Hudson Climate Smart Communities, and I think the thing that strikes me the most actually happened after the committee, and that was in Public Works, where Legislator Lauren suggested to the folks at Public Works that they start reporting to us on any progress being made on the audit, any progress being made toward energy efficient retrofits or solar. So that to start to, just as you were doing with the fleet, to start making the people that are most directly responsible. The environmental department has done a great job of processing the information of the audit and making charts that make it easy for us to see where the most energy is being expended and what the low-hanging fruit of recommendations is and what are some of the challenges. But to start working directly with those departments and when they report off, include a progress report. So other than that, I think we had representatives from Newcastle, Rosendale, and Woodstock at this meeting, and they all shared what they're doing. I think there's a real commitment in this committee to actually get things done and make some progress. So I'll let you read these notes. And maybe by then you have the digital.
Yeah, we're
all okay. Okay, so let's cast a vote. All in favor?
Just say so.
Yes, for the support.
I try to be consistent also, Tracy. I remember last year I really felt it was a minority appointment. Disagree? That's life. I feel very strongly about it, but knowing how I was the accidental chairman, I thought it was the right thing to do to move forward the way we did. Quite honestly, regardless of how this stuff turns out after the end of the year, I think this grand experiment has worked in many ways. And maybe we can get by this Democrat, Republican, majority, minority, and just look for good folks to to be there. I know it's in the law, maybe to have a little bit of a hold on the tyranny of the majority, but as a matter of fact, my good friend Leon over there was a Democratic appointment. I'm very happy it happened. So I just wanted to say that I try to be as consistent as I can, and I believe it was, and I believe this, I don't know if anything fixes anything, but it's, I think it'll be fine for everybody to consent to it.
Okay, so all in favor of 457?
Aye.
Opposed? All right, Emerald Ashford is going to be, it wasn't going to be January's meeting, but since January's meeting may be up in the air as to when, it might just be on February, because it's a lot of moving pieces for names like 6 people. And I think February is probably the outside of a good time to do it, because there's so much winter and whatever. And soil and water, the industry, DEC, Amanda, the Ashford Task Force, so it's a lot of people. So,
is that
going to
be for us, or is that
going to
be
more of a public? Recycling Oversight Committee membership, I'm going to circulate that again, I'm going to try to really reach out if anyone can, committee can think of recommendations, make suggestions, just to get that moving, ideally at the beginning of the year as well.
This is, I apologize for squeezing in at the last minute. My name's Mary McNamara, as some of you. I'm with the Shokas Creek Conservancy, and Krista wrote me down as Ashokan Water, so I guess I'm really here for Ashokas Water. I understand that possibly, Nana, you've been bringing people up to speed with the conversations and the proposal that's going on with a private company to be purchasing water from a public water supply. I'm really just here to say the CEQA process has begun. There's been a positive declaration. And at the moment, the proposed schedule is to begin a public hearing January 22nd and have the final draft EIS for February 22nd. So I jumped in to make sure that if you do want to make comments on what's happening, that you'd be aware of it, and that if possible, it would be helpful to put the issue as an agenda item on your next meeting that is maybe a less crowded meeting. It is an intermunicipal topic, and it possibly is also an inter-county project. So it's the scale, it's the ownership, nationally owned company, and I'm overwhelmed at the types of projects you all have been dealing with tonight, and the range and sophistication and the focus you have on working on so many different issues. I appreciated the support you've given to keeping track of what was happening on the lower Shokas downstream of the Shokan Reservoir. This particular project is proposed to be built upon the shores of that same stream. And so it would seem a poor timing just when the stream is trying to get good projects going, good studies going, have money to implement recommended environmental improvements that what I would call an industrial use is being recommended. But the bigger issue probably is the fact that it's public water source, that a national bottling company is interested in purchasing, but it amounts to about 25% of their current use. So it's not insignificant. It's the water you drink, whether it's a plastic cup or a styrofoam cup or a metal cup, all the water that you drink here, except a lot of the water that's in the hallway, that comes from the city of Kingston's water supply, which comes from primarily 99% from the Cooper Lake Reservoir based in the city of town of Woodstock. And that water comes from the upper surface from the Beaverville, that is in the New York City water supply watershed. So many, many, many different moving parts, and I do appreciate your letting me just jump in here like this and say that. So there are about 15 different organizations that have all combined together to advocate for a smart process of moving forward with studying this, et cetera, et cetera. That's longer than I planned on talking.
Thank you for being so patient.
Thank you.
Is there anything that you would like to have presented to you to help keep abreast of what's going on?
Is Cooper Lake in the Chilcan watershed?
Cooper Lake itself is in the Shawtel watershed, or the lower Shawtel watershed, but the water that is connected, the water that fills Cooper Lake, comes from the Shawtel, or the upper Shawtel watershed.
What stream?
The Beaver. It's also called the Mink Hollow Brook, the headwaters. But it is.
But now, has that been diverted then? Is that water
it is, it's diverted by a weir that's connected to a pipe that then carries the water a very short distance to Cooper Lake Reservoir.
And that was done
in 1927. And the water withdrawal permit that guides that was one of the few in the state. This is pre-DEC that oversaw this.
Mm-hmm.
There is a minimum flow requirement.
Okay.
Half a million gallons a day, which is about 0.8 CFS, so most trout aren't too happy with that amount of water.
No.
But at least it does set the precedent for that.
I
could probably go on and on, but you all are too kind. So.
I'll take your contact number, and maybe we can speak in advance of the next meeting for attendance. None of our meetings.
Well, you've been so kind to look. We'd like to put you at the beginning.
I will say that January could be a little. January is potentially going to be wacky.
Hoping that it could be extended via the review process. It's possible that it is set in text.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Motion reason. Or is it not ready yet?
Not yet. All in favor?
Yes.
All right.
First of all, when you knew, didn't lock my door. Of course, when she did, I can't get in. Oh,
you got the key.
Oh, you got the key. Okay.
Will you give me a list of these?
Are we having
any other things? No, not of these people. This is all talk to you. That'd be great.
Can we resolve things that have been hanging and hanging?
But maybe it's not as pressing now that you and I need
right
to
talk. Right. Yeah.
She might be
in the hospital. I'm glad it wasn't my idea. Well, I'm a little hesitant to stick in it, but I did.
So, everything good?
Yeah.
Let's see. Jen talked about, she stuck to the pipeline,
mm-hmm.
And she did not. What was the other thing I wanted to turn her attention to? Oh,
this we're adjourned, but I just
is that all? It has, you know, she won't. But Central Hudson, just for the weekend. Yeah. Central